It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis joins us from Mexico City. He's going to be on the phone, I think. Stacey Higginbotham from Austin, where they're about to celebrate a special 4th of July. And Aaron Newcomb with another great project. We'll talk about the latest news from Google and a whole lot more. Stay tuned. Twig is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly, CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 359, recorded Wednesday, June 29th, 2016. Colonel Cutts. This Week in Google is brought to you by Atlassian. Unleash your team's potential with collaborative software tools like HipChat and Jira that let you work and communicate better together. Visit Atlassian.com to learn more. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we cover the latest from the Googleverse, the cloud, Facebook, Twitter, and anything else we darn well want to talk about. Jeff Jarvis is in Mexico City, and we've got him... He's time traveling via cell phone. Hello, Jeff.
What you're hearing right now is my scream. Ah!
Why? What's the matter?
Today. So the hotel Wi-Fi was beyond belief bad. I have been the pioneer of bad Wi-Fi.
Yeah, you're the king.
The worst Wi-Fi I've ever seen.
Oh, dear.
I am the king of bad Wi-Fi. So then at the venue where I'm speaking tomorrow, I said, well, I'll use that. They said, I'm going to give it a try. So then I tried Starbucks. No. So then I tried MiFi. That didn't work. So then I bought a MiFi, which in two languages is majorly challenging. And it worked okay in the store. I get back to the hotel. It wouldn't hit 1.0. It wouldn't hit a quarter of 1.0.
Yeah.
So then I just went through 4 hours returning it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I still don't have my money back. But this Leo Laporte, this is what I do for Twig.
I appreciate it. I thank you very much. So you're joining us via your Google Fi cell phone right now. And when you get back to the hotel in a few minutes, we'll get you on the hotel landline.
Yeah, so it's delighted to be here, even if I have a primal scream going on.
You know, my daughter's in Mexico for this semester as well. She'll be there through the end of the year. She's in Puebla, which is a smaller city than Mexico City, but similar issues. It's very crazy.
It's because it was a monopoly system.
Right. When you change from a government-run monopoly to a kind of half and half, or call it a slim, it really is a mess. Same thing in Australia. That's Stacey Higginbotham, who knows all, tells all, from the IoT podcast and parts south. She's in Austin. Hey, Stacey.
Hello.
Nice to have you. Yeah, I think the same thing happened in Australia. It was government run, and now it's like half and half. It's a Telstra's kind of half.
Yeah, when
half.
I was in Australia, I also bought a MiFi there so I could be on the show.
Yeah.
Wow.
Stop buying MiFis. Yeah, really. Don't you
Australia
have a
had,
no.
Go ahead.
Australia's issue is they have one, they used to have one cable coming in for data for the
right
for that whole, is it Eastern Seaboard, Western Seaboard? I guess it's
Eastern
Western.
Seaboard is the big population area where Sydney and everything.
Oh, okay. Eastern side. Telstra had access and controlled that basically. So broadband was crazy. You thought our caps were bad. Australia's were way worse.
But they have gotten better, I think. Also joining us, Aaron Newcomb. Great to see you, Aaron.
Hey, Leo. Glad to be here as always.
We don't usually get to see your lab. I like it.
I know. Well, yeah, actually, all you can see is my wife's half. That's her desk, her messy desk, all her books. She was a philosophy major, so there's tons of books back there. But on my side, there's like, you know, stuff all around here. Here's a Raspberry Pi Zero. Interestingly enough, if I can get to it, is the original Raspberry Pi and all kinds of other stuff. And just as way of a teaser, I brought a project, as always. So if you want to know what this is and what it does, you got to stick around till the end of the show.
A numeric keypad attached to something. Hey, did you get your $9 computer yet?
Yes. You know what? I left them down at the Makerspace last night. I got two of them. I got the HDMI add-on that you can just pop on. That was kind of an adventure getting that working. But so far, I'm very, very impressed. Maybe next time I'm on, I'll do a little I'll make that my project because it's at least I was telling people last night at our meetup, it's similar to in performance the first generation Raspberry Pi 1, which is actually saying a lot. It performs really well. I got the GUI running. I got a browser running with IceWeasel. It worked really, really well. So I would encourage people. And it has built-in Wi-Fi and Bluetooth for $9.
It is the chip computer. This was so exciting.
It is.
Okay. Yeah.
We had them on the new screensavers when they were doing the Kickstarter. They raised $2 million, and they've just started shipping.
Nice. So. Yeah, I think that's one of the most innovative things coming out.
Well, you know, why $9 versus $35 for the Raspberry Pi? That doesn't seem like a big difference.
It is if you're a school district or if you're poor.
If you're buying 100 of them, I guess, yeah.
I mean, even – and the idea – so when I talk to the next thing, guys – and Aaron, if you know this, I will shut up. But when I talked to the guys who are making it, they were like, look, you know, for $9, that's something a kid might have in their allowance. And if they're interested in this, they can just go out and get it. And it's
– good point.
Less for them. So this isn't for necessarily us. It's for people
right.
who $35 is a lot.
I ordered it. I pledged $74 for the pocket chip plus HDMI adapter. Mm-hmm. And then I got a regular chip. So I haven't gotten mine yet. So I'll have to look and see. Maybe they need my address or something.
Oh yeah, that was my mistake as well. I didn't see the email that they sent saying, you know, make sure you get this website and verify your address. Once I did that, I got it like in a week. So I must have hit it at just the right time.
I don't know why that happens a lot with Kickstarter. Like they have everything. They had to. I signed up I guess Kickstarter doesn't give them the information Kickstarter knows or something.
Maybe yeah, I don't you have know to why confirm they do double it. Does it confirmation take a while? Like that.
Yeah, it's kind of strange since I gave them money. I'll have to search through my email because I think everybody's gotten their chip, and I haven't. So, but it's a cool idea. So you're right. I mean, that's a third as much, less than a third, almost a quarter.
And then the
as
great
much.
Thing about it is it's completely open source, open hardware. You can go download all the stuff.
What's the processor?
It's an Allwinner A8.
Okay. Is that an ARM? ARM processor?
ARM processor, and it runs, you know, full stack Debian. So just like the Raspberry Pi does. So if you're familiar with Debian or already familiar with the Raspberry Pi, most things will work. You'll need different libraries to control GPIO and those kind of things because they're dependent on the chipset. Yeah. But otherwise, if you know Debian, if you know how to use Linux on the Raspberry Pi, you should be able to do things like update software and use the GUI and use the terminal emulator and all that kind of good stuff.
That's cool. So it has a full X GUI and everything. That's really cool. God, that's amazing for $9.
It is.
It's also good for project makers because if you want to make a, you know, I was at the Harry Potter ride in Universal Studios last week, and you know, they have on the wall, they have the Harry Potter style talking paintings, you know, paintings in Harry Potter don't just sit there. The people move around, they wink at you. And I always had this dream. In fact, maybe we'll do this in the new studio of having all our hosts on the wall in what looks like still pictures. But every once in a while they go, yeah, or wander off and come back. And of course, the way to do that, it wouldn't be that hard to do with a screen and a simple computer in the background. This would be all you'd need, really.
Yeah,
makes it much
and
more affordable.
If you could get an old style monitor or something that had a composite input, I mean, this comes with a composite breakout on it.
Oh,
so
it does.
It's got one of the combined audio and video composite jacks on it. So it comes with the plug. You plug it in, and you get your video left and right channels. So if you can find an old monitor and mount that in a picture frame on the wall, really all you would need is this $9 computer.
They did a really interesting thing in the one, and I'm sure that's exactly how they do it at the Harry Potter ride, but they've kind of crack-a-lured on top of it. So it looks like it's an old, aging oil painting. They must have just, you know, painted a varnish on top of the screen. So it doesn't look like a screen. It looks like you're looking at an oil painting. And it's even more dramatic as a result when the thing suddenly moves. It's like, whoa, whoa, I could have sworn that was an oil painting. Maybe you could help me with that, Aaron. We could be a fun project. We could do
absolutely
that on the know-how or in the screensavers. Yeah.
You bet.
Jeff, are you still there?
I just got to the hotel room. So, Aaron, if you want, Carson, if you want to call me, we'll check, make sure the line
is. All right.
And then we'll switch.
We'll hang up on the cell phone as we walked through.
No, we'll hang on.
Okay. It was fun. We got a little walking tour of Mexico City. How's the air?
Yeah. Well, it's okay today.
Is it really hot, though?
No. All right. It's decent.
Good. All right.
Cooler than Anaheim.
I got a little distracted, but we can move on. There's been a lot of speculation when they talked about it yesterday and all about Android, about what's going to happen to the Nexus phones. There's, it's all rumor at this point, but the impression some people are getting, and this comes from an article in the Telegraph of the UK, is that Google is going to stop doing what these Nexus phones are, which is essentially developer editions, and start doing premium smartphones to compete with Apple and Samsung. Credible? What do you think, Stacey?
I actually have a Nexus phone. I would love for Google to actually do this. And now that they have Rick over there,
Rick Osterloh from Motorola.
Osterloh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I see no reason why not. I would say, what the heck? I don't think they would have to contract manufacture it out, but
that's what they do right now, yeah. Right, Aaron? Is these, they're not making the 6P or the 5X.
No, LG.
That's right.
And,
yeah, they.
Go ahead.
Who makes the 6P?
Ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say.
Huawei makes a 6P. I'll answer my own question. And you guys fight it out. Huawei makes a 6P and LG makes the 5X. And in the past, they've used HTC. HTC made the first Google Android phone, the one with the slide-out keyboard. The G1, I think it was called. And they've used all the manufacturers, under the sun. So is the Telegraph story that they're going to build it themselves? Why would they even bother? Who cares? Even Apple really doesn't build the iPhone. Foxconn does.
Yeah, okay. And they may do this. They may take the same approach where the components get, shipped in from various places and they put it together somewhere. I think it really is to solidify a phone that actually works instead of having, because I probably going back and forth between Huawei and LG and can you please include this feature? Right. We want to do X, Y, and Z. And they're like, we don't want to do that. It's too expensive or whatever. So there are always these negotiations back and forth from the manufacturers. And I think they just want to jump that whole process and say, look, we're just going to do it ourselves and put out a phone that we know has all the features we want and works the way we want it to work. They probably are looking to compete more with Apple. Not only that, but then they actually start making some revenue as well, as opposed to the majority of it going back to the manufacturers.
And there's the whole – I was just going to add to that. With Samsung being the biggest seller of Android phones, Samsung's actually been disabling and tweaking Android to a certain point that's kind of really frustrating for users. So I can see Google being like, all right, got to take this bull by the horns and own it.
I've been using for about 5 or 6 days. I got it on Friday, I think, the new OnePlus 3, which is an interesting, really interesting phone. It is in every respect equal to the iPhone or the Samsung Galaxy S7, I think, very close in every respect. It's $400, and it's pretty pure Google experience. They're using their own Oxygen OS, but that is as pure as you can get. I mean, it's similar to the Moto X, that kind of, a few extensions, a few differences, but it feels like Marshmallow. The big question, though, and I think for $400, it's a no-brainer. This is, don't buy the Galaxy S7, buy this. But the big question in my mind is updates, and I think a lot of people are asking is updates. And one of the things that you could guarantee with a Nexus phone, and I presume with a high-end Google phone, is that you're going to be using the latest OS and always get the latest security patches. In fact, that's one of the reasons probably Google would like to do this.
Yeah, having owned high-end Android phones my entire smartphone career, for the most part, I'm on Verizon, and Verizon is always so late on updates.
That's terrible.
That's why I switched to a Nexus, is because just like, So it makes sense.
I only
went off Nexus one time. I've been, since the G1, I've been using only they weren't called Nexus back then, but Nexus phones. I got a Samsung Galaxy S4 at some point, and the updates were so slow. I used the stock, you know, OS for a couple of weeks before I rooted it because it was just awful having to wait for in this case AT&T to put out an update.
Of course, the one thing about this OnePlus 3 is it's easy to unlock. I think it may even be an unlocked bootloader, and if you could put any ROM on it you wanted to. So, you know, in some ways you have more, you'll have more flexibility, certainly a lot more than Samsung gives you.
Well, did you see the news? There are discounts on, was it Nexus phones? Amazon's doing discounts on certain Android phones.
Yeah, the Amazon front page is interesting. Let's go there right now. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about what this means for like the hardware model versus, I don't know, everything else and who owns the phone and does it matter anymore?
So this is the Blue, which is a kind of little known in the U.S., but well-known internationally. They make Windows phones as well. The Blue R1 what's interesting is what they're doing for Prime members is they're giving you a version with offers and ads built in, kind of like the Kindle. And that one's less expensive than if you get the version without ads. With ads, it's, I think, $50. Without ads, it's $100. $50! And then they're also selling a Moto G. I don't know if the Moto G... by the way, you have to be an Amazon Prime customer to get this. So this is one way. You know what? I'm not logged in, so it doesn't know I'm Prime. But this is one way Amazon is spiffing Prime users and getting them. Yeah, $150 for the Moto G. That's not such an incredible price. Neither of these phones is a high-end phone, however.
No, I just think I thought it was interesting that Amazon was putting their ads on somebody else's device.
Isn't that weird? They must have a. Do you think they must have a deal?
They have to have a deal. So that's what I'm thinking about. Like, okay, so what does it mean to own a mobile phone ecosystem? Like going forward, if someone else can put ads on it, think about how it interplays with like the smart home. I'm just kind of thinking about kind of everything, especially as more and more things get unlocked. Sorry, my brain is just kind of going all over the place today.
It is interesting. $229 without the offers and ads for the 32 gig version. $179. You say $50, and if you can survive with 16 gigs, which I don't recommend for most people, as low as $150. That's for the Moto G, which is quite a good phone. Not, I would say, if you can afford to spend a little more, get a little bit better phone than this. But if you can't, maybe for a kid or somebody who doesn't have a lot of money, $50. For the 8 gigabyte Blue, wow. Can't imagine. It runs very well. It's got a MediaTek 1.3 gigahertz quad-core processor. But it is, I think, it's more interesting as a story about Amazon and what Amazon's up to than it is about the deal itself.
Right. Sorry. Yes, that is true.
Go ahead, Jeff.
What do you think they're up to? What do you think their bigger strategy is?
I don't know. Stacey, you got an idea? What is this plan?
Okay, let me think. Ads on devices, selling other hardware. I'm just thinking about... Yeah, I have no idea.
Well, like, okay, I'll wade into the waters here. After all, for years, we bought subsidized phones from carriers.
Right.
And so we thought our phones were only $200. And then we found out when carriers stopped the subsidies, what the phone actually cost. And I think that has put some downward pressure on phone prices on everybody but Apple. And it's changed how people think of the phone. So this is, in a way, Amazon's subsidy, right? Obviously, they have to negotiate this with Motorola and Blue. But the subsidy is we'll take $50 off if you don't mind lock screens. And they have done this with, as I said, with the Kindle and the Kindle Fire tablets. I have both Kindles and Kindle Fire tablets with offers. Never bothers me on the Kindle, because mostly on the Kindle, you don't ever see the lock screen except the first time you turn it on.
You get the ads at the bottom. And
not while I'm reading a book, though. Only when I'm browsing the library.
That's true. Now, I have the Kindle app on my phone, and I get Kindle ad notifications or Amazon ad notifications.
You see,
now, I
think that's annoying.
I think it's super annoying.
Yeah, but you can turn that off. I mean, you're not.
Yes. Yeah. I have turned it off.
Yeah.
But this gives you the permission to send notifications. So it could be a similar experience.
It's just doing that? No, because it's the lock screen. Although, wait a minute, though. Let me think about this. If I'm listening to a Spotify song on my Android device, the lock screen is the album art. So it may be maybe they don't need the manufacturer to do this. Maybe this is just a mechanism where they as an app, they just put an app on here and it takes over the lock screen because it's always playing in the background. I don't know.
Who's going to buy a $50 phone and see?
Not me.
I would buy a $50 phone because I bet there's a way to load your own OS onto this pretty easily and bypass all of that.
Right.
Right. Because the hardware should be independent unless they've built something into the firmware that says, you know, do a check. And if it's not working, turn off the radio or something like that.
Is this possible,
but it's hard to do.
It's really interesting because I almost feel like this is Amazon throwing something against the wall and seeing if it sticks, because it doesn't make sense. If you're a Prime member, you're paying $100 extra a year for the privilege of second day delivery. You're, I think, by definition, an affluent customer. So why you would be interested in a $50 phone as a Prime benefit seems puzzling to me.
If you have kids, I mean, I would look at something like this for my 9-year-old.
Yeah. They don't care about the ads. It wouldn't even be legal to show them ads, actually.
Maybe they couldn't.
You might have to certify that you're over 13 to use this phone. Huh. Wouldn't that be weird? So getting back to the original premise, if Google were to compete with Samsung and Apple with a Google-branded, couldn't be Nexus, I guess. It'd be a Google-branded, made by Google phone. You know, here's the real problem. We've been at peak phone for a year. There's nothing new that you could put. That's why OnePlus can sell a $400 state-of-the-art phone. There's nothing, you know, it's got a fast fingerprint reader. It's got a good camera. What else?
Well, so this gets into like the phone is going, is the phone, because I'm having this discussion with people I talk to in the Internet of Things space. Half the world believes that the phone is the key to, like, owning the phone is the key to controlling the next ecosystem in tech, which is everything in machine learning, right? The other half are like, you can control other platforms and still access it. So if you look at us being at peak phone, does it matter that you control the hardware? Does it matter if you can control the OS? Or matter rather that you sell them and you get their email address? I don't know. Like
What everybody's got to figure out is what's going to get people to buy a new phone besides they broke the old one.
Yeah. People will buy a new phone every
eventually.
I mean, the Samsung gambit is to put out special things with it. So at VidCon, I actually bought the Samsung 360 camera. There's the Samsung Gear. I've made fun of that strategy in the past, but I don't know. Maybe it's the right way to go is that it's not the phone. It's what you can get with the phone because it's well integrated.
Well, it's certainly Apple's strategy. Apple's at WWDC, they basically said everything works better as long as you have an iPhone and an Apple Watch. Then everything's tightly integrated. And by the way, I should point out that the one thing you wouldn't want to do with this 1.3 is VR because it's a 1080 screen. So you will have to buy a 1440 screen from Samsung or one of the high ends if you want to do the Gear VR. So that's, I think you're right, Jeff. I think that's one way to make sure people don't buy these lower cost phones.
But how many people?
The Samsung. Sorry. Go ahead.
You, Jeff. Go ahead.
You go, Jeff.
I was going to say I can't see you guys. The integration of the Samsung 360 camera with the phone is pretty damned awesome. It's stitching on the phone as you're shooting. You can see what you're shooting in live 360. You know, could you do that on the other phone with the software? Well, maybe you could, but is that a huge market? No, but the integration is really impressive.
Get ready, because there's a guy in Florida who's suing Apple for $10 billion. He says, oh, no, I invented the iPhone in 1992. He's got a drawing. He's got a patent. And he says, Apple stole my idea from 1992. He was, according to the lawsuit, the first to file a device so designed and aggregated as to have a creative, a novel combination of media and communication tools. So his identity was then since then hijacked by Apple's iPhones, iPads, and others. Wasn't there a Palm Pilot around about that time or other product? I guess the Pilot was much later.
Well, a Newton.
A Newton. I mean, anybody could draw a picture. He never made a phone.
Yeah.
Did he get a patent? I guess he did.
Is he in the Eastern District?
He's in Florida right now, but he absolutely should move that lawsuit over to the Eastern District of Texas. I hear Tyler, Texas is great this time of year.
At EFF, I didn't know this, there is a Mark Cuban chair of getting rid of stupid patents.
Yeah, Mark's been very aggressive. Yeah. By the way, the Telegraph has a great little bit at the bottom here where they show Apple's revenue since you start reading this article.
Wow.
And it's almost $1 million.
Wow.
Yikes.
And awesome. That's a counter. So I guess they could afford $10 billion. Isn't that funny? Since you started reading this article, and I've been on it, for a minute or two, Apple's made almost $1 million. So it'll cross $1 million in a few seconds. Ross's patent was never approved because he didn't pay the fees, and the application was declared abandoned in 95, but he still claims Apple resorted to dumpster diving. Oh, come on. This will be thrown out so fast.
I just
want to see your head spin. It'll spin faster than those numbers on the screen.
Who took this? Does he have an actual lawyer?
Waste of our court system.
Yeah, typical. Yeah. Nuts. It's like the woman, all right, what do you think, who sued Microsoft for $10,000? She's a travel agent just down the road here in Sausalito, who says Microsoft forced Windows 10 on her computer, and then when she tried to revert to Windows 8, it wouldn't work for days. She lost a lot of business. She sued Microsoft, won. Microsoft decided not to appeal. They were going to appeal initially, decided not to appeal, and paid her $10,000 for the forced upgrade to Windows 10. Unbelievable. Let's see. What are you there for, Jeff? Why are you in Mexico City?
So I'm here for the TAG CDMX conference, which is an effort to kind of rebrand Mexico City and bring in some cool people who are around me. And so I'm speaking about the end of the mass tomorrow. Last week I was in VidCon, which you were so close, so near.
You know,
yet, so far.
It's so funny. I'm eating at a restaurant and there's all these people from VidCon, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, I'm like a block away.
Yeah,
but
You didn't write.
I didn't go. I was on vacation. So how was VidCon?
VidCon was great. I'm just amazed. 25,000 people now.
Wow.
Unfortunately, sadly, because of the two tragedies in Orlando, the security was much higher.
Yeah.
But still, this year I got to take my daughter, because last year I was in deep trouble for not taking my daughter.
Because she wanted to meet who? Who did she want to meet?
Well, I forget. Well, I'm a good dad because she got to meet John Green.
I never heard of him.
One-on-one.
Never heard of him.
He's co-founder with Hank Green of VidCon.
I got in trouble with Michael, our 13-year-old, because apparently McJugger Nuggets was there. He said, McJugger Nuggets was just down the street, and you didn't tell me!
Who's McJugger Nuggets?
You don't know who McJugger Nuggets. You don't have a 13-year-old. You don't know McJugger Nuggets?
I have no idea.
Consider yourself lucky.
It's fun to say.
You know.
Is it a boy thing?
It's a boy thing because it started off with a video that I think a lot of people thought was real of a brother making a clandestine video of his brother playing video games and their dad going ballistic and taking the brother's Xbox and all the games and putting it out in the backyard and mowing it with his lawnmower tractor. And the temper tantrum that McJugger Nuggets threw. And then it turned out my kid thought it was real for the longest time. I'm sure you deal with that as well. And then it turned out.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah,
video.
Yeah, sure. You remember McJugger. By the way, the last episode, just a few weeks ago, he killed his father. It's called Psycho Dad. Here you go. Here's the Psycho Dad. This is the brother. I don't know if this is the first one or the last one, but There you go. You got it. You can turn up the audio. So there's a lot of shouting and swearing. And he throws his Xbox in the fire for Christmas. Merry Christmas, Dad.
Are you crazy?
You've got my stream open, Carson. Anyway, we don't need to watch any more McJugger Nuggets. But apparently he's huge. I mean, that video you just saw has 19 million views.
Wow.
He's huge. 32 million for the one that I was talking about where Dad shreds the Xbox games with a riding mower. And the fun of it, of course, is the kid's reaction. He's a good actor, because I wasn't sure this was fake either at the time.
Yeah.
But now, of course, we know this is a... So he was at VidCon, too. So it's that stuff. Jeff... Oh, here we go.
Well, it's that and more. I mean, you know, I watched a couple of amazing panels, Leo, about mental health, for example, where you had the YouTube stars talking about how my latest post on Medium is about this. I had them talking about their depression, their eating disorders, their suicide, you know, whatever. And in the room are people who feel the same thing, and it's just a room filled with empathy, two-way empathy that you just don't see in big old media. That you can meet these people and talk to these people, and it's something different. Now, it's a big business. Susan Wojcicki from YouTube, the CEO, gave a keynote, and they're giving, you know, they're putting big money in people's pockets. Fiji Simo from Facebook was there. Facebook announced that they were going to add a live promo box to people's homepages soon, which will be a big deal. YouTube announced that they're going to add a live button sharing button to all YouTube players soon. Live is going to be bigger than ever. So it was. I was.
Is there any? Is there any? I guess not at VidCon, because it's really a fan. What am I hearing? Where am I hearing that from, Carsten? It's not. I'm hearing this. The audio stream back. There you go. Is there anybody at VidCon who stands up and says, "You guys are crazy. This is YouTube ripping you off. You're working in YouTube's minds." And
well,
is there any dissent at all?
A little, yes. I went to a session but it's reasonable dissent. I went to a session on fair use, or as Professor Larry Lessig says, fair use is the right to hire a lawyer. So they were sharing techniques about how to avoid problems. They were lamenting when they've gotten strikes and they've had huge problems. They wished for more contact from YouTube. But they were more reasonable about it than Hollywood and their discussions. But I thought I was going to stand up and say, you know, you guys should have kind of a union or something to gather together so you can have some strength. And damned if at the final keynote for the creators, Hank Green, the founder, with his brother, one of the Vlog brothers, the founder of VidCon, stood up and announced the creation of an Internet Creators Guild, which is at internetcreators.org, I think, or com, where they can stand together more. They can use it to lobby. They can use it to lobby government. They can use it to lobby the platforms. And you know, on one hand, yeah, Leo, YouTube's getting a big chunk of the money. But the other hand, without YouTube, most of the people would have no mechanism to get any money.
Yeah. It's just me, but I really feel like it's a fool's game to put your stuff on YouTube. I guess, you know, people have made a lot of money, but I just feel like YouTube's making a hell of a lot more. And in most cases, with the exception of the McJugger Nuggets and the PewDiePies of the world, most people are working their butts off for below minimum, effectively below minimum wage, like 99.9%.
Well, but that's true of Leo. That's true. That's ever been true of authors and artists.
Right. Any glamour novelist profession
can do that.
Yeah.
No, well, that doesn't excuse it, does it?
Well, yeah, I'd accept that. What's the market? If your video gets 1,000 views, then you get paid commensurately, and that's that.
No, but you don't get paid commensurately. That's kind of my point.
Well, but here's another way to look at it. Which is that There's sorry, it's my sister. probably in a phone. Most of those people would never have gotten a video to the public, or you know, in the days of book publishers.
See, this
you have to go through a big gauntlet.
I understand, and so for just by the way, the same as it's always as it's ever been for the handful, the top 100 YouTubers, success, glory, fame, and money. But that really belies them, literally, the tens of millions of other YouTubers who are really killing themselves trying to achieve that. And I think that YouTube uses them.
I would say that no, I'm still going to argue that YouTube gives them the opportunity to reach a public and maybe have that shot, which Hollywood never, ever, ever gave them.
You agree, Stacey?
That's always been true.
Yeah.
I think it's true of any sort of creative endeavor. I agree that like actors are probably a bit more protected. But I also think about journalism, which not as glamorous, but still, you know, there. I worked as an unpaid intern at magazines while I tried to like.
Yeah, that's the old days, though. So look, okay, here's an example. Same thing. When I was in radio, worked my way up, got crap jobs. I never got below minimum wage because that would be illegal, but I had crap jobs. But I, you know, I worked. There is a union, blah, blah, blah. And I worked my way up. Nowadays, if somebody wants to become good at it, they can make a podcast. The mistake, what I'm saying is the mistake is to say, oh, I'm going to put it all in YouTube and let them sell the ads and share the revenue because they'll screw you. I mean, you could do it yourself.
So yeah, I agree with both of you. The problem is, like Jeff was saying, that it's hard for people to do all that stuff, especially when they're first starting out. And so they go to YouTube because it's an easy way for them to get started. But I agree with you, Leo, in that the better way to do it is to do your own stuff and use all the various distribution methodologies that you can, like you're doing.
We post on YouTube, but we don't expect to make any money from YouTube.
Right.
YouTube for these kids is probably like the digital equivalent of like moving to LA if you want to be an actor, right? So you have to get your stuff on YouTube to get discovered.
You know, I understand that, but I thought we had a better way these days than having to do that the old sweatshop way.
Okay, Leo. Okay. All right. So
I think
YouTube I don't know if it's going to be for everybody, but for big publishers. You know, Twitch is a sweatshop, but we'd love to be in here.
This is not a sweatshop. Wait a minute.
No, it's not.
Now, admittedly, look, I'm a capitalist. I don't pay you a full share of what we make on this show. I pay you, and I hope it's enough, but I don't pay you a full share.
Oh, you bet it is. But, you know, the truth is, Leo, close your ears, you wouldn't have to pay me a penny, and I'd beg to be on Twitch. That's absolutely true.
Well, I wouldn't do that, though. So there's an example. So if I were YouTube, I'd go, yeah, come on, and we could do that, Jeff. And I feel like you should be paid for your time.
Okay, but here's a change. The change you want is coming, at least at the high level where it always starts. The new YouTube player will be white labeled, so the publishers can use it as their player and sell their own ads on it and backfill as they wish.
That'll never happen.
Ads.
That'll never happen. Google will not let that.
It's happening, Leo. No, Leo, it's happening. It's been promised to the publishers. It's happening imminently. It's being
only the big
publishers in Europe.
Yeah, the big publishers.
That's where it'll start. That's where it starts.
Yeah.
It's where it always starts. Facebook, YouTube, Google, it always starts with the big guys.
Right.
And the little guys get pissed. But no, the precedent is going to be there.
Well, and so, maybe because there's competition. Facebook, we know, is paying at least $50 million to celebrities and media companies to kind of prime the pump of live video. They want to get in this game as well.
I'll wager you, though, Leo, that 90% of those people who are paid by you,
they're celebrities.
Would get a lot less if they tried to sell ads on their own.
Yeah, no, but it's Kevin Hart, it's Gordon Ramsay, it's BuzzFeed, it's CNN. I mean, it's not.
I'm even talking about the YouTube little guys.
Yeah.
If I could sell my own ads, which is what you're saying they should do, you know the structure you need to sell ads.
Right.
It's huge. It's expensive.
And it's tough. I mean, we're selling ads now, and I'm sort of legit in what I do, and it's still like a pain in the butt. And if you're like a 14-year-old YouTube star, that's not going to happen.
I would just say, consider YouTube an amazing deal if you what you think is you're getting free bandwidth and exposure to a large audience, but don't consider it to be a path to making a living, because it really isn't going to be, and they're taking advantage of you, I think.
So that's also if you think your living is going to be on ads, but what about endorsements or getting fancy cars?
Well, that's what
or
you have to
lifestyle?
Do. That's what you have to do, right? If you're going to make money on YouTube, it's not really from YouTube you make your money. It's selling, you know, cosmetics and other things.
I think that's
Sorry, Stacey, you go. You go.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I think that's actually what they're striving for. They're not looking for ads. So.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Stacey,
I'll take the next step. What I see happening all over is these so-called influencers, which the FTC is, you know, cracking down on. But I see this all over, where they are indeed selling ads under the noses of Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and Snapchat,
right.
Because they're selling their influence on products.
Right. Well, the reason I ask this question is I'm just curious if anything like this conversation happens at VidCon.
Yes, to a civilized extent, it does. Yeah. The motives for a lot of people being there are to find friends and to be famous and
it's social.
To make money.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, that's a good measure of it. And then those who then do have the ambition, they get some of them big enough to go off on their own. Some of them wish that they had more contact. But Susan Wojcicki announced that they're going to have a huge increase in the customer service for YouTube because they realize that's a complaint. You know, they're doing some things.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about Facebook shortly, too. You have to be aware that these platforms live first and foremost to serve their users in their definition. And, I'm arguing that we should work in partnership with them, but we can't fully count on them either.
Yeah. Well, we've said that for years. We've said for years, if you're a brand, if you're the Financial Times, you shouldn't be putting your content on the Facebook platform because you don't own it. And yet everybody's doing it.
Well, and
because publishers don't have a strategy.
You have to go to where your public is.
Because they're stuck.
Yeah. And the days of the destination, well, here's – when I was in Europe, I got this conversation I had where you go from an era of the destination, which is I own it, come to me, and I own you, to distribution, which is, okay, I'll go chasing you on Facebook. The next thing that happens, I think, is a product era where you create products that are – specially beneficial to people, and they come to it because it's useful to them and it's worthwhile, but not because you just make content and force people to come to you and market,
right.
But instead they feel like there's something there, community, utility, friendship, social, whatever it is that makes them come to that product you've made for that community. That's where we have to head.
Stacey, do you think you said this is because they don't have a plan? This is just they're falling into it because they don't know anything else to do.
Falling may be a little overstating. I think they're like, they see these successes on YouTube and they want to do that. And so that's where they go to do it.
Right.
And they model themselves after their idols.
But also, I'm talking about big publishers though. I mean, you come from that industry, you know, these guys. I look at what it was a good article about Jeff Bezos as a patron of journalism at the Washington Post. Clearly, he understands what a digital-first strategy looks like. And it seems like the Washington Post is – and his staff is getting it and buying into it.
I think there's a lot of –
Yeah, but they're still in a volume-based business.
Yeah.
Well, and there's still – it's very hard to give up the cachet that comes with being like this amazing print publication.
Right.
I mean, you still get – I mean, when I was at Fortune – people still were like, will this be in print? I'm like, why would you
care?
Who cares? They didn't even send me the print version of the magazine. So, like, I don't know. This has been crazy. And most of them they don't have a plan for digital because they don't understand it. And half their employees are, you know, union and old school and stuck in the older era. And the other half are like, what are you guys doing? And it's very different writing for one side or the other.
There's a great article from yesterday in New York Magazine about the Washington Post. And they tell a story that when Ben Bradley, the legendary editor at the Washington Post, the guy who was memorialized in Watergate story. When Bad Bradley passed, Jeff Bezos wasn't going to go to the funeral. And I think it was Marty Baron or somebody called him and said, Jeff, you don't understand. You have to go to the funeral. This newspaper you bought, this is Ben Bradley's paper. You have to go. And Jeff said, I'm on my way. He understood.
I think he called, yeah.
Yeah, he understood the symbolism of attending. And, you know, Marty Baron, speaking of people made famous by a movie, of course, the guy featured in Spotlight, seems to really embrace what Jeff is doing. They've built a new kind of high-tech newsroom, moved him out. They apparently were over the printing presses, as many newspapers are, and they moved him out and put him down the street. And it sounds like they've got money to spend. I don't know. Do you know what's going on at the Washington Post, Jeff? Do you talk to people over there?
Yeah, they're a little Bezos secretive, but yes, they have gone all in on Facebook. I talked to one executive there, and he said that they went to Bezos and said, we want to test this Facebook thing. And Bezos said, well, how are you going to test? And they said, well, we'll put up like our 10 articles a day. And he said, well, what articles? Our best one. And Bezos said, that's not a test. Test it. And they did, and they're happy. It's doing well against their incremental revenue in their view. They've really, you know, what the fight, the old fight at the Post was about local versus national. And print was local and national was digital, and they had a huge fight, never settled to the dying days of the Graham family ownership. And clearly Bezos came in and said, oh, no, this is a national fight. Let's put all the gas we can on the pedal. And they are now bigger than the New York Times in the U.S. in terms of audience or traffic. And so that's what they're doing. But they're still in a volume-based business, I think. But they're doing very smart things. They were the first ones to do progressive web apps with Google. They're the first in on a lot of things because they have the good technology talent and the willingness to work at it. And I think he's made a very good product, all in all.
You're right. It was Bob Woodward who emailed Bezos and said he was the soul of the institution that's now yours. You got to go to the funeral. And Bezos says, understand, on my way. He also, of course, famously sent his private plane to get the journalist who had been held hostage.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Stocked with, I love this, stocked with food that he liked. He checked ahead with his friends and found out that he liked burritos. When Jason Rezaian, how do you pronounce that, Rezaian, was released from an Iranian jail, Bezos flew into Florida on his private jet stocked with beer and burritos after asking Rezaian's friends what his favorite foods are. That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Bezos is a cool guy. He's a tough guy, but he's a cool guy.
Yeah. Well, and there's a long history of journalism being supported by patronage.
That was actually a model that could come back. I mean, who is it? It's one of the Microsoft guys is funding journalism into like brain research and kind of bio. I don't know if it's bioethics or just biology kind of startups, but or not the startups themselves, but journalism into the space. And if you think about that's a model that works because the stuff that scales and gets you massive ad revenue is most often crap.
Right.
I mean, bless it. But you have to pay for the real journalism. But when you atomize your revenue streams with digital, which is what you do, you look at it and you're like, well, this economically doesn't make sense.
All the crap floats. That's the problem.
Yeah. So patronage sounds good, yeah. Either through like individuals funding you through Patreon or one
big rich
individual.
Yeah. Today, Facebook published its criteria for the news feed, which I thought, I don't know, have you had a chance to look at this yet, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a quick post about it, which you'll find there.
Okay.
The Facebook did two things today. One was that they, for the first time, gave people a little more transparency into the algorithm to the extent that they said, here are the principles that guide what we do.
News feed values. Yeah.
Right. You want your family and friends first. That's our job. That's what Facebook does. People also want to be informed and entertained. Now, when I've heard this in the past, it was the opposite order. It was friends, entertainment, information.
I know. This hasn't been my experience. Here's the quote. That's why if it's from your friends, it's in your feed, period. You just have to scroll down. That's not been my experience, but I'm...
No, that's not true. That's not true. No, because a lot of my friends put stuff I don't want.
That's...
but at the same time, the second thing they did, which is that they also tweaked the algorithm to say, yes, we're going to favor friends even more. And they're warning news organizations there may be an impact. Well, the news organizations went batfish. Oh, pardon me. Sorry about that, Carson. Edit. they went crazy. And the New York Times... shock, they're going to show us cats, no news, they're a news organization, what are they doing? They've never been a news organization, it's never been a priority, this is a matter of degree. But the Neiman Lab post was the most reasonable, but most of the other posts I saw said, oh my God, they're going to de-emphasize news, everybody who's partnered with news with Facebook is basically an idiot. Well, we got to wait and see over time and experience and data what actually happens. Yes, there's an impact. But the real lesson here is Facebook is not a place to read 1,000-word articles. Facebook is a place where you discuss things. Yeah. And we in news have to feed those discussions appropriately to the platform. You know, we don't get mad because Snapchat will not let us put up an article, and we have to make things specially and appropriately for Snapchat. Well, Facebook is trying to gently guide us there, I think. Nonetheless, all my Eeyores in the news business all went crazy today saying big bad Facebook is ruining news again. And I don't think that's the case.
So the problem, one of the problems, I should say, is that a lot of news organizations in the last year or so have oriented towards Facebook, and it's a significant driver of their traffic when you're trying to achieve those crazy scales. So it makes sense that everyone's like, holy cow, they're changing the algorithm. It's like the Greeks when they were like, oh, the gods are mad at us again when, you know, it didn't rain in enough time. That's what it feels like. So I don't know.
Are they going to start sacrificing goats on Mark Zuckerberg's porch is the question.
They'll be sacrificing journalists, as per usual.
Farhad Manju's headline in the New York Times, Facebook, a news giant that would rather show us baby pictures.
Yeah, that's just so condescending, not only to Facebook, but to every user of Facebook.
Yeah. I think, actually, I'll have to say Facebook, from my experience, is doing it about right for me, personally.
Yeah, same here.
I go there and I see a nice mix. I do see a lot of news, and I can't verify that I'm seeing everything my friends and family post, but I see a nice mix, and you're right, and I don't want to necessarily see everything my friends and family post. Facebook's ultimate metric is, how much time you spend there, period. And they're going to just...
And they have the data.
They know
what you like and what you don't like.
So they're gonna just watch and see what you like and what you interact with, and they're going to give you more of that because that's their only real job. Right?
The lesson here is the same as it is to me from VidCon. It's the lesson I learned last year at VidCon. They're not about content. It's about social tokens. You make things to serve the conversations people have, and you can serve it with journalistic value, with facts and fact-checking and information and explanation and education, but you do it appropriate to how people live their lives. We don't do that. We still make a destination product called an article. Well, sorry, folks, but that's what we have to rethink. And Facebook is not so gently making us do that.
You know, it's really happening. It's another similar shift from the library to the internet. So the way you use the library is very different the way that you use the internet. But the library is the old days where you would go to the library and you would get something to read. And similarly, you would go to the New York Times site and get something to read. But nowadays, you don't need to go to the library. You go to the internet, which is this tossed salad of things to read. If you want to find something to read, you can, but you're not going to go to the New York Times. You're going to go to a news aggregator or Facebook or Twitter, and you're going to see a story you're interested in. Read that, and then read another, you know, a crouton from the Washington Post and an onion ring from the New York Magazine, and you're going to move around. Is that an apt analogy?
Leo, let me ask you a question to get you in trouble. Are you saying that libraries should close?
Well,
Wait, Jeff,
as repositories of books? They need no, they shouldn't close. What they should do is that they need to rethink their role in an internet age. They're no longer the place you go to find facts.
They know that.
Of course they do. It's the thing librarians have been chewing on for 20 years.
Yeah, and I really think they're trying – what they should do, libraries' role should be to provide community services for people to educate themselves, get access to things that they haven't been able to – I know like our library is doing a lot with literacy, adult literacy, for example. They're doing a lot with – a lot of libraries are opening up makerspaces. I don't know how they do that. In a quiet environment, like a library, but they open up makerspaces and they have 3D printers and other things. And it's an investment, but I think those are the types of things that libraries can be a wonderful resource. Everybody knows where the library is, or most people do. So you go there to learn a little differently. You might not check out a book, but maybe you'll learn how to 3D print a holder for your tablet or something like that. And
so to extend my analogy, perhaps to the point of breaking, just as a library has to rethink its role in an internet era, so does a news journal. Because you can't expect people to go to the front page and read from the top to the bottom and see a giant full-page ad for Macy's. It doesn't work that way.
I think maybe the publishers have to. I mean, most journalists think of their job not as – they think of their job as providing information, I think.
Right.
Most of the people I do know do that.
That's a better way to hold it.
The business model, though, God help us all.
Well, that's really the real problem, isn't there? I mean, and frankly, the libraries also face that. If you're in California, funding for the library is so bad that libraries are now not open but a few hours a week in the public library in many cities. And our library here is basically just a place where books are that nobody wants to read. And so it's homeless people there using the bathrooms.
Yep.
Our libraries are great. We've got people coming in using the computers. We've got, I mean... I will confess, I check out still probably 5 or 6 books a week for my life.
Because you have a 9-year-old.
Not just because I have a 9-year-old. It's because I don't like paying for like Kindle downloads because they're so freaking expensive. Yeah. I'm like, $10? I could get this at the library for free.
Yeah. But you are in a minority. I doubt it's really crowded there.
Actually, there's a lot of people on the computers.
Oh, good.
And...
Yeah,
using the internet.
That's exactly it.
And I've done workshops there teaching people how to use software for like job training, and I think that's actually a really I think that's why better broadband access to libraries is so important, and I think a good library can serve as like a digital ambassador to people who otherwise are going to be left behind. So, and it's a good place for books.
Yeah, I completely agree. Our library's been very good at partnering with our makerspace. We've done learn to solder days or learn to solder workshops there where people just come in and they solder a little thing and learn a new skill. I'm going there on the 6th of July, I think, and we're going to do a take apart night where kids, middle school kids, can bring in whatever they electronics or anything they want, and we're just going to tear it apart and learn how it works. So I think there's a huge role, and I think that most libraries, like you said, Leo, are trying to figure out what it is that they're going to do. But I think there's a huge role for libraries to supplement education in their local communities.
They really just need to stick a learn to code sign out there, and then taxpayer dollars will just flow right to it.
But as with newspapers... do we adapt the legacy institution and try to fit it into a square hole, or should you just create a whole new institution where people can go use and learn the internet and use the bathrooms, or should we rethink how we do news, or should we rethink education? That's what entrepreneurship and innovation do. And then but it's inevitable that the legacy players will wind their heads off and argue that they're being killed, and newspaper people are the haughtiest of all. I think, Leo, back to your question about VidCon, the difference is, they're all affected by the platforms, but the haughtiness of the news industry versus the reasonableness of the VidCon people is a stark contrast.
Were there any mainstream media people at VidCon, or was it all new media?
No, Gannett was there. There was some.
Fortune had someone there.
But they're there on a field trip? They're there to cover it? They're there to learn? What are they there for?
Well, here's my line. The first floor of VidCon, literally, is the fans, 17,000 of them. The second floor of VidCon is 5,000 creators. The third floor is 3,000 industry executives, old white men who exploit the two floors below.
Okay, you agree with me. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Well, I'm part of the exploiter.
Oh,
I'm
so am I, for that
matter.
Yeah.
Doing
my best to exploit everybody. Anyway, not as effectively as some. It's Susan Wojcicki. She's good. She's really good. All right, well, let's take a break. We'll talk more about all of these issues, and there's some actual hard news as well, like a new 700 trillion pixel cloudless satellite map from Google, a Chromebook Pro, and a $2.8 million space where Google is supporting Black Girls Code. That's really cool. Right now, though, we're going to talk about a company supporting us with their great products. It's Atlassian. We use Atlassian like crazy here at Twit. We use Jira, which is a great way to track, manage, and assign tasks. In a big coding project, first experienced Jira in our website, our new website design. The team that was building it used Jira. It was great. We were able to put our ideas, our needs, our requests, our desires into Jira. They were able to parcel it out into little tiny chunks and then assign that to an engineer. Then the engineer can move the chunk along. And it's a great way. It's agile, sprint-based, and it's fantastic. I've never seen such an easy way to take something hugely complex and make it simple, keep everybody on track. No, everybody knows exactly where you are. That's Jira. Then there's Confluence. We use Confluence here in the studio. Our engineering team uses it to create documentation about our workflow and our hardware. Instant messaging via HipChat is the best. We use it like crazy. I should show you our HipChat room. I mean, we have people, we create, the beauty of HipChat is it's easy to create a new room, and we create rooms every time we've got a task. We've got a room, of course, for our new studio. We've got rooms for engineering. We've got rooms for booking. HipChat is more than messaging, though, because you can also integrate in a lot of other tools like Jira so that you can get alerts and information about how things are working. We have server alerts and things like that. We love these Atlassian programs. And if you use Git, if you're a programmer, you'll love Bitbucket. It's a better way to Git. Test, review, and manage code in real time. It all comes from Atlassian, putting together tools to make it easier to collaborate, to work together. We use it for everything from planning events to working on operational issues, all of our communications. It's better than emails, better than phones. It's Atlassian, Atlassian.com. And you can try it free. See how Jira, Confluence, HipChat, Bitbucket will give your team everything you need to organize, discuss, and complete shared work. Atlassian, helping teams everywhere team up to create what's next. We used it for our, we liked it so much, we used it for the app development for our new apps. And it's great for the studio design stuff. And the build and the engineers use it. It was interesting to get the contractors using it at first, because at first our project manager says, well, I'll email you. And Lisa said, no, put it in HipChat. Oh, okay. But once he got used to it, like the flow is so, so good. Thank you, Atlassian, for your support of This Week in Google. I love Stephen Levy's article in Medium, Back Channel. By the way, who bought Back Channel? Condi, right? That is weird.
Bought by them? Because wasn't it a Microsoft?
No, Backchannel's is Medium. Remember, and they hired Stephen Levy away from Wired to run it. And everybody's wondering, well, what is Ev thinking? How are they going to make money?
Well, it was backed by, I think it was backed
was
by Microsoft.
Oh, that's interesting.
They paid like a one-year sponsorship of it, basically, that paid for Stephen.
Oh, I did not know that. Well, they've got a great team, and now they're still on Medium. This is, boy, talk about an interesting experiment in journalism. They're still on Medium, but now Condi owns it. I still don't see any ads in it.
And they have a new editor, don't they? Jesse Hempel.
Oh,
Wired.
I love Jesse. Yeah,
I think I just got an email from her.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that's really interesting.
So let me see where she popped up. Yeah, because I love Back Channel. I
read it all the time. It's become really a go-to. It's weird. Magazine within a site. I don't, it's a very, Jeff, you write for Medium all the time. You've been the one who's been telling me all this time, and I'm the one laughing at you.
Oh, Jesse is the new head of editorial for Back Channel.
Oh, cool.
So there you go. That's
she's her. Writing for them. I have seen her byline.
Mm-hmm. And she's awesome.
Yeah.
She's very good.
So great article last week, how Google is remaking itself as a machine for learning first company, how they're putting, as I've said in the past, a thin layer of machine learning all over everything. One of the, he buries way down. He's talking about how they've got a program to become machine learning ninjas for their coders, and they're trying to train everybody as fast as they can and adding machine learning. But way down in the article, he kind of buries what I thought was very interesting, which is there's a machine learning tool called RankBrain that they've been using for some time for some small percentage of Google searches. In an interview that Stephen got with somebody at Google, the guy had a search, I think, at Google, he said, yeah, we're using RankBrain for like 90% of all searches now. I don't know enough about what RankBrain does to know what that means, but that's – so this is Google. RankBrain is involved in – according to Dean, who is – not Amit Sehgal, who's the master of search, but
Who is it who left really recently? What was the guy who's – he left recently from Google – he had kept them from using machine learning.
So this is how Stephen, I think, kind of nicely categorizes it, is there are two schools of thought when it comes to search. There's the what he calls the retrieval school, which is how you and I probably think of search, which is you go out, you spider everything, you bring it all, you index it, and then somebody retrieves it, like looking up in a card catalog at the library, the search results. And then there's the more difficult but more interesting artificial intelligence technique, and that's the one that is now winning out. RankBrain is involved in every query and affects the actual rankings, probably not in every query, but in a lot of queries. What's more, it's hugely effective, Levy writes. Of the hundreds of signals Google Search uses when it calculates its rankings, RankBrain is now ranked as the third most useful.
That makes sense.
There's always this battle between the retrievers and the machine learning people. The machine learners have finally won the battle.
I think it's probably a better way to characterize it would be you've got the machines, you let them do their thing, and you let the people come in every now and then and tweak it. So less of a battle and more of a, oh God, singularity. Ah!
Cooperation. The machines and the humans are working together at last. All right. Nothing more to say about that. I thought it was a very interesting article anyway. Google Maps is getting a new 700 trillion pixel remake facelift, cloudless now. The satellite's pictures are cloudless. It's the first time Google Maps satellite map has been updated in 3 years. I didn't know this, but a billion
Google
people
sucks
use
up all the clouds on Earth.
Yes, that's the headline. Write it today. More than a billion people use Google Maps every month. You may not have it already, but you'll be getting it soon. 700 trillion pixels of new data. What?
Wow.
What?
Think about the bandwidth that's going to suck up if you're like trying to find something real fast.
What? Here's an example. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just saying this is from the Atlantic article. Here's an example. Christmas Island, which is in the middle of the Pacific, 1,000 miles off Australia, is so remote that actually it's in the Indian Ocean. It's so remote that it's frequently obscured by clouds, but there are no clouds in the new map.
Oh, yeah.
Say this is interesting in the scope of it and the enormity of it. But at the same time, I mean, I know for me, I almost never use satellite anymore. I use the regular map view.
Really?
And I use street view.
Don't you like those pretty pictures? I like the pretty pictures.
My daughter loves
it. No, it's easier for me to navigate and find out where I'm going if I use the regular map. If I use satellite, it's like, it's all blah.
Yeah, the abstract version.
I use it only to snoop on my neighbors and see houses I couldn't otherwise see because they're too far back.
That's, okay, shameful admission. I do the same thing. Like, do they have a pool over there? I think they have a pool.
Yeah.
And you zoom in. Yes, it's a pool. So part of the problem, I guess, was the pictures that they were getting from Landsat 7 were marred by these diagonal lines. This was a physical malfunction on the satellite. But now they have a new satellite, Landsat 8, and it doesn't have the same problem. It's been operational for since the spring of 2013. So there's a lot better, crisper, newer data. So that's kind of cool. Neat article. I like the Atlantic. They're pretty. They've been getting more and more geeky.
They're very good.
Yeah,
they are good. Look at that. That's where the money is. Geeky stuff.
Yeah, I said that for years, but it took nobody believe me.
You might be a little too geeky.
Oh,
I know. I'm in the too geeky camp too. So I'm like, oh,
can't win. A little too geeky.
Do we want to talk about Google Fiber and buying Webpass, or did we?
Yes. No, this is a great story, and there's a side story that's related about this. This comes from a Medium opinion piece by an apartment dweller about how Comcast and the other incumbents basically have a monopoly and make exclusivity deals with apartment buildings. And as a result, a lot of apartment dwellers, which is the majority of people in the United States, are forced into poor situations. If you live in an apartment, you have no choice but to get your internet from whatever the apartment offers. And Comcast and others use their leverage to and kickbacks to ensure you have very poor connection. Webpass is, I think, Om Malik's apartment building. Maybe you can remember if this is true. It does have Webpass, because Om's always saying, I have the best internet access. It's so good.
He started complaining about it in recent years, but for the longest time, he had 200 megabits per second when it was back in 2009. So.
And that was because the apartment owners, it worked as a co-op and made a deal with Webpass, and Webpass put fiber in. So they've just been bought by Google Fiber, which will give Google a foothold into this big apartment market in San Francisco, San Diego, Miami, Chicago, and Boston.
Yeah, they're buying so the Webpass is a point-to-point service, but the fiber's throughout the building. So I think Webpass, does it use microwave?
That's interesting. So it gets a high-speed connection to the building, and then the building distributes it to its customers.
That is my understanding of how Webpass is. I mean, unless recently they've changed things.
So I was, because I remember Om talking about it, and I think that's what Om's using. So that confirms it. Yeah.
Yes. So in Suzanne Crawford, who's the person who wrote Medium article, she's the one who actually was very prescient talking about how the cable companies were basically building up a high-speed broadband monopoly a couple years back because none of the telecom guys were investing.
A warrior for the good guys here, yes.
She calls it, what is the phrase she uses, the new payola.
The new payola. So it's not, I read this and I was like, come on, Susan. Because this isn't new. This has happened for decades. And the FCC actually made rules trying to prevent it. But the problem is you have to wire up these buildings. And so the cable companies, they're all through San Antonio, you can go and find U-verse only buildings because that's the infrastructure they put in. And it's sucky, but if you get enough people, my understanding is now you can change those rules, but you do have to get enough people and go it is a pain, and it's horribly unfair, and it's kind of a legacy of our crappy internet infrastructure plan from way back in the 90s.
Crawford, who's a professor of law at Harvard, writes that the FCC made a rule 8 years ago that says landlords cannot have exclusive agreements. In fact, they knew there was a problem. This is the FCC. Incumbent providers commonly engage in a flurry of activity to lock up MDUs, that's multiple dwelling units, and other real estate developments in exclusive arrangements. As soon as it becomes clear a new entrant will be coming into town,
The problem is that you can make a rule, but these big ISPs are not dumb. So they do all sorts of interesting things. She quotes a story about apartment building, and here's a letter from Comcast saying, I'm writing to you regarding an incident that occurred recently in a nearby apartment community served by Comcast. A new provider, Google Fiber, had set up an on-site marketing event on the property in violation of the exclusive marketing provisions. So you can't have an exclusive, but you can have an exclusive marketing deal. Unfortunately, it put the property in a difficult situation as they were required to remove the Google sales team immediately. Fortunately, the property owner recognized the error when we contacted them and worked with us to rectify this situation. Or as she says, put down that Google donut and get the hell out. So there's ways and ways, even if there's a rule against it. Shenanigans are everywhere, she says.
The ISPs are super smart.
They're not dumb. And
I mean, but this is also, I'm sure you guys have probably covered this back when it was announced, but I mean, Google is, you know, trying to get around this by
That's
laying
why.
Their own
yeah.
fiber. And they, I guess the new Trans-Pacific 60 terabit per second
wow.
cable is going live on June 30th.
Wow.
Apparently. I don't know mm-hmm. if you saw that, but it was in the news probably like a year ago or maybe more that they were going to do this. And apparently it's ready to go live here.
The other side of this is you as an apartment renter have some power because after all, isn't that one of the first things you ask about before you rent a new apartment is what kind of internet you got?
It depends mm-hmm. on the – I mean, if you're in San Francisco finding a place, you're like, can I
You'll
afford
take whatever
to live
you
in this
get.
Hovel?
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know.
It's not a very – it is definitely a seller's market in some cities, but where it's not, you should really insist – We're moving studios, and one of the real incentives for the move, when we moved in here 5-6 years ago, we got Comcast to trench from way down the street there all the way up to here to put in fiber, and we spent a lot, I think thousands, $5,000 a month or something for 150 megabits of symmetric fiber. Mm-hmm. The new place, a local provider, one of the really best independent internet service providers in the country, SonicNet.
I love Sonic.
Aren't they great? Well, they're local.
Yes,
they're from Santa Rosa.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
So it turns out we're looking at places, right? And everywhere that we go, I see a little thing that says, oh, yeah, we have gigabit here. And I'm going, hey, this place has gigabit. This is awesome. So I'm friends with Dane Jasper, the founder of SonicNet. I've known him for years. He's the guy with the Linux license plate. We've interviewed him before. And we talked to him. He said, Dane, what can you do for us? So we're getting, get ready for this, 10 gigabits symmetric in the new studio. 10!
Wow.
Nice.
Can I move in, please?
I'm going to move in.
What are you going to do with that, man?
Well, we as it turns out, we do consume bandwidth like popcorn. So we'll find ways to use it. So we were really thrilled. I mean, that's a selling point. To have gigabit
available.
It
totally is.
Yeah.
It is.
I won't stay at a hotel anymore unless it has fast internet.
Jeff, you should learn the lesson.
I won't come to a country anymore unless it has fast internet.
So anyway.
There's a crappy hotel down in Silicon Valley that I stay at when I go down there. And the only reason I stay there is because they have normal Wi-Fi throughout that they don't – you just sign on. You don't have to sign into a page. You don't – and it's super fast. I can watch Netflix. I can do what I want. And so that's my top choice. Even though it's a crappy room with a crappy bed, all the rest of it I can get work done. I think the same is true. It's becoming increasingly more the case that you want to have fast internet no matter where you go.
Here's the problem, Aaron. Here's the problem. There isn't – what the world needs is an honest, fact-checked database – of actual speeds in prime times in hotel rooms, number one.
Yep.
Number two, we need suits against hotels for false advertising. We need a definition of high speed and a definition of what's not high. It's just awful.
Oh, you know, so I talked to the people who run Hilton and is it Marriott? No, Hyatt. Those two hotel chains to actually ask about how they – when these companies franchise out, or I don't know if it's really franchising when you're a hotel, but they actually have standards for internet access that they make their hotel chains follow. What's crazy is
oh yeah,
it differs based on location. So like the type of city, how many stars a property has, like the status of a property. I think those are the two big things. And so I was actually surprised because some of them are like relatively decent. But some of them are like, you know, oh, and how many rooms, the size of the property. But some of them are like 300 megabits per second for a property that would have like 300 rooms. And I'm like, yeah, no, that's not legit. So I was kind of shocked that that even existed.
So Jeff, hotelwifitests.com. It's a crowdsourced,
SeatGuru for hotel Wi-Fi?
It's like SeatGuru for hotel Wi-Fi. It's a crowdsourced database. And what you do when you go to a hotel, you test the Wi-Fi and you upload the data to the website. And they have 395 hotels in London, 139 hotels in San Francisco, 200 hotels in Barcelona. I mean, all over. So you can actually, you know, if I were in a hotel right now, I'd say yes, and it would test the speed and it would upload it to its server automatically. So you're right. I think this would need. But I think what you're seeing, though, already is a considerable improvement in all of this because more and more people want high-speed internet. And as that becomes more and more expected, there's more pressure. I mean, the days – there still are plenty of hotels that charge you $15 a day for internet. But there are far more hotels now that start that are saying free internet.
Well, the main gig now is free basic.
Yeah.
If all you want to do is email and then pay for the high speed. But then you pay for the high speed, they don't deliver it.
I know. But I think that this is – we're in a transition. But I think there's significant market pressure now, not just on hotels but on apartment buildings and on renters and rentals and everything.
But I want some legal pressure too. The FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, should make itself useful – And be enforcing the definition of high and the delivery of high.
FTC has a definition of broadband, right? But I don't know if that's...
Yeah, well, but it's for different... It actually is different in two different places. I'm going to give you a shred of hope here, Jeff, because last year,
Yay!
Marriott became the first hotel to offer Netflix in their guest rooms. And as part of that deal with Netflix, they had to actually guarantee their broadband speeds to each room.
Right.
So, I'm a Marriott member. I try to stay at Marriott when I can. Oh, good news.
So there you go. It's enough to stream Netflix in the room because that was actually one of their big issues, that and figuring out how to make sure how to sign people out automatically if they didn't sign out of their Netflix accounts. So we might actually see those kind of deals because, I mean, I don't even turn on my hotel room TV. I just sit there and find something on my computer and watch it.
That's what I do too. I think this is a potential business opportunity for Google, frankly. I mean, look what they've done with Starbucks. What if they picked a few hotel chains and said, hey, look, we'll provide your internet access to your guests if you let us be,
Ooh.
You know, have the sole proprietorship of the internet and just outsource
brilliant.
It to Google. I mean, I think it's a win-win.
Or pay over.
Brilliant, Aaron. Really brilliant.
Wow. If Jeff says I'm brilliant, I'm feeling good.
Google's also responding by building its own internet speed test tool. And I haven't got this feature yet, although some people say they have. One of the problems with speedtest.net, which is run by Ookla or Netflix fast.com website, is that ISPs know about these and they will, you know, see that you're going there and they'll hoax the results. So if you search for speed test what's my speed test or check internet speed on Google, some people at least are getting a button in the search results that say run speed test from Google's measurement labs.
Well, they also did for YouTube. I don't know if you guys noticed this, but you could actually check your broadband quality on YouTube and it would show you if you're ISP was, this was back during the peering debates.
Right.
But I thought fast.com was by Netflix.
It is.
Netflix built that. Okay.
Yes.
Not speed test.
No. Ookla does speed test and fast.com is done by Netflix. Exactly right. And now, or sometime coming to a browser near you, Google may have its own.
Measurement Labs does a lot of really cool testing. So that should be fun.
So Measurement Lab is not Google. It's another company. It's a third party.
Measurement Lab is a nonprofit from the OTA. Hold on. I used to work with them when I was doing all the peering stuff. They're really MLab. Google has backed them, but I think it's the...
Oh, this is kind of neat.
Open Technology. What? OTI? I'm terrible with acronyms.
Anyway, you can find out more at measurementlab.net.
There you go. Oh, New America's Open Technology Institute. There we go.
Cool.
And academic researchers, Google and Planet Lab Consortium, and the Planet Lab Consortium.
Speaking of which, you might wonder, where's Matt Cutts these days? Because he may not be able to join us for a while, because I guess he's gone to work for the Pentagon.
Uh-oh, Matt Cutts in a uniform.
I don't think he has to wear a uniform. Though we queried him, and he said, well, I might be able to, but I am starting a new job, and I'll let you know after I ask them if I can continue to do This Week in Google.
I'm sorry. It's Colonel Cutts to you.
Colonel Cutts. I'd like to say that. Lieutenant Hutt.
I like that, yeah.
He's not leaving Google, but he's joining the Pentagon's digital team. This is actually, it's the Defense Digital Service, which was formed last fall to improve the DOD's ability to solve complicated IT issues and develop new technologies. And so this is kind of cool. He's wanted to, as a lot of coders have wanted to, kind of take his skills and bring them to government to improve transparency, to make government work better for us. He says, over the last couple of years, I've seen more and more people in technology trying to make government work better. They're idealists who are also making a large impact. It's like Code for America, people like that. There are people I respect. Some of them have worked to fix healthcare.gov, for example. I think a lot of Googlers went on loan for that. From talking to many of them, I can tell you the energy is contagious, and they're trying to improve things in all kinds of ways. I want to see whether I can help, too. So for the next few months, I'll be taking a leave from Google. I'm joining the U.S. Digital Service family, specifically the Defense Digital Service at the Pentagon. And he's moving to D.C. as part of the change.
Wow.
So,
and let us now please pay tribute to Matt for bringing his wonderful clout to bear to solve the incredible best of the year moment on Twig last week with poor Jason.
Was Matt on last week?
No, but Matt rescued him after the fact.
You know, he rescued him. Week, right? I should tell you what happened. Were you here for that, Jeff? Because I wasn't. Yes. I was on vacation.
Yes, I was. Jason is wonderful. He threw himself on his sword for the sake of the show, for the sake of the entertainment. I would have gone completely, completely crazy, insane, had to leave. He kept his good humor. He used it as a lesson, but he needed Matt's rescue. Now explain.
So he decided to turn on two-factor while he was on the show on Google. And unfortunately, and this is a bug, if you ask me, the phone number that he uses and would use to verify that he was, in fact, you know, getting the right codes and everything was a Google Voice number. So, of course, as soon as he turned on two-factor, he was logged out of Google Voice and then was unable to, as a result, get the confirming text message that would allow him to use it, thereby locking himself out of all Google services. Is that correct?
Yes, he was in a recursive loop of hell that the only way to get out of it was to do what he couldn't do.
That doesn't seem possible.
As we pointed out the show, as Gina said, Google should know a Google Voice number and say, you don't want to do that. We're smarter than you. Yeah.
So I haven't talked to Jason since he's on vacation right now. So Matt Cutts helped him fix it. As usual, by the way, Matt, we love you, Matt. And I know you're listening right now, even though you're deep within the confines of the Pentagon. But I think they still have reception there. What kind of bandwidth do they have at the Pentagon? You think they have 10 gigabits per second? Anyway.
You're going to enlist, Leo?
Hey, I got it. I don't need it. But he's saved our bacon a couple of times, too. When we screwed up, he intervened for us, as I think you know, and he's intervened many times. So thank you, Matt, for intervening once again for the Twit family. You're a good man, Matt Cutts, a good man.
And he also put in a bug report that said, we might want to change our UI on that park, which is very Matt.
Can't be the only person who's done that.
I've talked to people in other tech companies and other divisions of Google, and it's funny how Matt is now a touchstone. Because when they get into trouble and have a lack of trust, what I hear people say, honest to God, I've heard this from three or four places, you know, they need a Matt Cutts. And it's true. He is such a human being. You know, he's going to listen. He's going to trust. He's going to be reasonable. He's going to level with you.
He's the best.
You know, you feel in good hands. He's the best. So, Matt, on your jog right now, I hope you're grinning.
So is he moving his whole family? I guess he is to D.C.
I don't know. Wow, I don't know that. know.
That's commitment to public service. Thank you, Matt, for doing that. And I don't know what the term of his service will be, and I don't know what whether he'll come back a colonel or just a staff sergeant. But hats off to you, Colonel Matt Cutts. I like Colonel Cutts. It sounds a little bit like something from a Clue game, like Colonel Cutts with a lead pipe in the study.
No, it sounds like a movie from the Vietnam jungle.
Yeah, oh yeah. The horror, the horror. Cuts.
I love the smell of Java in the morning.
Did he, somebody's saying, did he come from the government to Google? I can't remember. Somebody said that in the chat room. I don't know if that's true or not. It's funny how little we know about Matt Cutts. I'm going to have a t-shirt made that says WWMCD. What would Matt Cutts do? Let me just see. He started his career at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So he's kind of going home and joined Google in the year 2000. 2000. Oh. Can you believe that? So I think he must have come straight out of college. He was working on his PhD at UNC.
Is he Dr. Cutts?
He may be ABD Cutts. I don't know. We'll have to ask Matt. all but dissertation, right? I don't know what I don't.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's a good question. He was working on his PhD at UNC. Matt, I'll call him Dr. Cutts from now on. He has an MS.
I like Colonel Cutts.
He's an MS. It looks like he didn't get his PhD, if Wikipedia is correct. But he's from that area.
The world is better off for it.
He grew up in. Yeah. I didn't know this. He grew up in Kentucky, which is why he's such a nice guy. That explains a lot. 2.8 million dollar facility for Black Girls Code inside the Google headquarters in New York City. It's a nonprofit hoping to give better opportunities for students and increase diversity in the tech industry. And that's more than just, you know, paying lip service to getting some diversity. I think that's fantastic. It's a gift from Google, yep. By the way.
So I have a lot of questions about this. Did you read, I mean, when teaching or when saying that you're going to teach someone how to code and expecting that to like solve problems?
No, it doesn't. Of course not.
So yeah. Like, oh, I like this. Does it also help, you know, provide training on how to interview well?
Right.
Money for clothing so you can get a job if you want it. All of these other ancillary things.
In some ways, I think the first step and the most valuable step in diversifying Silicon Valley would be to get some perspective and some different culture into the products that we make in Silicon Valley. That would be a very good first step to make, not merely making it, I mean, obviously, eventually you'd like to have lots of jobs too, but even just having it not be less of a monoculture would be hugely valuable. You saw the last episode of Silicon Valley where they made a great product, but only engineers liked it. Nobody else could figure it out. And that's a kind of a problem in Silicon Valley.
And that's why you need diversity.
That's exactly like, right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've been arguing that for years. Yeah. But the best way to make that happen is, I mean.
Well, it's a start to bring people in and say, right. Here, you're working in Google. I agree. I understand. Yeah. In fact, one of the things I love about App Camp for Girls is they really emphasize it's not just coding. If you're designing an app, you need all kinds of skills. You need to be able to maybe some people are designers. Some people are marketers. There's lots of skills. And I think that that's really the way to look at it is there's a variety. You can contribute to technology with more than just coding. I agree with you, Stacey. I think emphasizing coding is probably a bad idea. On the other hand,
I don't actually disagree with emphasizing coding. I'm just saying that it takes a lot more than coding,
right,
in teaching someone to code to make them a good potential employee.
Right. I do think I would like to see coding, and actually maybe you and Aaron can weigh on this because you both have younger kids. I'd like to see coding be at least an equal partner to math in schools these days. In other words, the skills that you learn in math are not math. I mean, you're not going to use algebra in real life unless you're a coder probably or an actuary. But what it teaches you is rigorous thinking, how to solve problems. you know, how to stay with something until you understand. I mean, it has, there's all these extra life skills that you learn over and above math, and coding can do exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. I talk to my son about this all the time about, you know, he always asks, well, what is all this math I'm learning good for? I'm never going to use it once I, you know, get out of school.
Right. And you can say the same thing for programming.
This is an example. You know, he comes to me a while ago. He said, I want to, you know, he's big into video games, of course. I want to learn how to make video games. I'm like, well, that's what you use your math for. You're going to have to know this stuff.
How old is he?
You can do some really cool stuff.
How old is he?
Oh, so he just turned 17. And interestingly enough, I was on vacation as well. I'm glad we synchronized our vacations, Leo. I was on vacation last week as well, and I took him to kind of a college tour back east as we were visiting some family. So we stopped in at Cornell.
Neat.
And it was a great tour. We took the engineering department tour. And one of the questions I asked them, what's the ratio men to women in the engineering department? And they said that it was above 50% women, actually.
What?
In their engineering group, which I thought was a fantastic number to have. But they said, except computer science.
Oh.
Yeah. Except computer science. So all the other engineering majors are 50%, you know, if you take them and average it out. But computer science is still a lot less. So I think programs like this are really, really necessary. Like you said, Leo, just to introduce the concept and all the additional learning that you can get out of coding. We use coding. It's not just coding in the makerspace anyway. We teach coding, but you have to know the coding in order to do something. It's
to make something.
An end result in mind.
Right.
Exactly. So you're doing a project. The laser maze I mentioned before is a great example of that. We need the code to get the thing to work. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So you start with this, I think it would be cool if you could do this. And then the coding is one piece of that giant puzzle. In making something come to life or bringing your idea to life. And so that's what we teach in the makerspace. But I think this is fantastic just to introduce coding someplace where it may not be introduced otherwise, I think is fantastic.
Stacey, does your 9-year-old daughter have any interest in tech at all? Or?
So sometimes, and this is actually worth, I don't know if this is because why. Okay. But as a girl, there's a robotics club in her school, and they do a lot of, it's not just battle bots, but it's making robots. And she is so not into that. She's like, screw that, like straight up like robot-y things. But she is interested when I showed her like projects about using Arduinos to, there's a project to teach, to use an Arduino to program a lemur feeder for the Oakland Zoo.
Oh, neat. Awesome. Yeah.
And she was like, we can feed animals with this? And that, so, and then there's a girl, they started a girls kind of oriented tech club at her school. And like the project that they were working on was building a trash can that when you stuck a new piece of trash in, it would weigh it and give you like data on how much space it would take up in a landfill.
Wow.
And they, so I think part of it is when my daughter thinks about making something, she's thinking about making something a lot of times with more of a social component. And I'm not saying it's...
No, that's her. That's not gender specific, but that's her.
And so like, I think once we broaden tech out to like more applications beyond just like video games or something that has historically been a little bit more, I don't know, male or loner or whatever. I mean, I built computers with my dad, so I've always been more of the guy side of tech maybe.
But that's the argument about bringing diversity to Silicon Valley is... Instead of thinking the same applications that we're already doing is to get some diversity in there, maybe you'll come up with something like weighing garbage. I mean, that's the whole point.
Yeah, or you'll put a period tracking app in HealthKit.
There you go. Isn't there one?
There is now, yes. Yeah. But it launched without one.
Right.
Because...
Well, and I mean, along the same lines, Apple made a big deal about, we've adjusted the Apple Watch now for people who are not walking but in chairs. I didn't talk about insensitivity. And if you had more people in wheelchairs in the Apple campus, maybe this wouldn't have happened. The Apple Watch tells you to stand up every hour, which must be very frustrating. So they've changed that. And then in the new Apple Watch OS, you'll be able to say, you know, get active or something else. And they're even, instead of just measuring pacing and steps, they studied how people use their wheelchairs, how they move their arms. Apparently, there are multiple ways of doing that and making the watch work with that. And all of that comes from having diversity in the building. Otherwise, you don't think about other people. So
it's true.
Yep, this is good. We all agree. I'd be interested to see what's going on with the Chromebook Pro. So Google initially at WWDC said that you will be getting the Play Store on three different Chromebooks in June. One was the Chromebook Pixel 2015. One was a Asus Flip. One was an Acer. It has arrived on one and only one, the Asus Flip, which I don't think anybody has around here. I wish I did. I'm crossing my fingers it'll arrive on my Chromebook. This is the pre-release. You have to be in the developer track to get that. Now, I wouldn't expend too much energy on this, but do any of you use the Google Opinion Rewards app? I do. And you get these surveys. And some of the surveys are...
Yes, I use it all the time. And I'm so pissed I've not been asked the question you're about to say.
Wait, is that the same thing that asks me questions about restaurants I've been at, or is that a different one?
That's another thing. It's different. The Opinion Rewards is actually, you must get it, because here's what happens. First of all, there's something satisfying about being asked your opinion, as if they care, right?
As if it matters.
But so the it's actually quite satisfying to take these little surveys, and sometimes they're very just two questions. Sometimes it's one question, like, you know, do you heliski? No. Thank you for participating. But you get money. You get credits in the Google Play Store for participating in it, which is really cool. Anyway,
that's better than the expert points I get for answering questions about restaurants.
No, this is much better. That must be Foursquare or something.
That's Google Local.
No, it's Google.
That's Google. All right.
That's Google Local, which is separate. Sometimes they will ask you for reviews, but this asks you. But it's also wonderfully freaky because it knows exactly what stores you've been in.
Oh, yes. I do see that sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't have any surveys at this time, nor do I apparently have any credit. But a Redditor says, look what I got on my Google Opinion Rewards the other day. How would you think a Chromebook Pro is different than a Chromebook?
Man, if I were in marketing, I would run all kinds of surveys just to get people talking about my
I don't think it's meaningful at all.
And Stacey, you're right. This was a marketing question, not a product development question. I'll bet anything.
Right. But what would a Chromebook Pro be for you? Actually, the Pixel is a Chromebook Pro, right?
LTE.
Yeah.
Plus LTE.
Yeah. I love my Pixel. I think it's great. But you're right. It's missing that one feature, LTE. It's also heavy. I'd love to see it as nice and robust and bulletproof it is. It's still pretty heavy. It would be nice to be a little lighter. But with the same great screen, the same great keyboard, I actually love the 4:3 aspect ratio of the Pixel. The nice thing is there are lots of good choices. Dell's now making an excellent Chromebook. Many companies are. There's some really good Chromebooks out there, and some of them even are not very expensive. There's some high-quality Chromebooks at $250 to $300. So,
yeah, we looked at getting a Chromebook for my daughter as her first computer. We ended up passing down a MacBook Air, but I know.
If you're 9, you'd be lucky to get a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, she doesn't always realize how lucky she is with the hand-me-downs.
I know. Hand-me-downs, yeah, that's it. That's it. My 13-year-old stepson has a 2012 Mac Pro cheese grater running Windows so he could play his Steam games.
Wow.
That's lucky.
That is lucky.
Hand-me-downs. It's probably the only benefit to having a father who's a tech journalist or a mother who's a tech journalist. What does Brexit mean? Actually, Jeff, I've been dying to ask you this. What does Brexit mean to all of these EU suits against Google and others? In fact, apparently the EU, according to the journal, is set to issue fresh antitrust charges against Google.
Yeah, I think, I've been thinking about this. And in fact, I was asked to write an op-ed, blog post for an EU commissioner, which I'm trying to figure out what it would be. And I think what I would say is that it's a time for Europe to make friends more than enemies. That you'd expect me to say that. But I think that given the break with the UK, and God knows what's going to happen there, and it's just so Trumpian, and people don't email me for saying that. But I think the European Union could be more isolated. The more they try to be the power broker and the tough guy, I personally believe that the less success they're going to have. Whereas if they take the power they have to say, how can we be collaborative and how can we be the friendly people of Europe rather than those idiots in the UK that did what they just did, they'd be in a better position. But I don't know where it's going to go. Yeah. It's just so wacky.
Margaret Vestager, the EU's antitrust chief, who has already skewered Google and is currently investigating for favoring its own shopping service and search results and for how it imposes restrictions on Android phone manufacturers, says that she's advancing investigations into whether Google is abusing its dominance with its advertising service. Advertising is 90% of Google's revenue, of course. At issue is whether the company prevents or obstructs website operators from placing ads on their website to compete with Google's advertising business. What?
That doesn't make sense.
What? Are you saying if I use Google AdSense, I can't use some other advertising service? Of course I can.
Well, you know, the thing I've always said quietly, and you know I'm Google fanboy and all that, but the one area where they are the most vulnerable, where they do have a monopoly, is in advertising sales. If you are an advertiser and you decide not to use Google, you have a tougher time in life.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so.
You mean in search results?
Well, you use Bing. Well, not just search results. but because Bing. Of DoubleClick and everything else,
yeah.
You know, Google has considerable hegemony over the ad business.
It's better to be a Google customer than not.
Yeah, but whether they use it improperly or not is another question.
FTC closed a similar investigation in 2013. After Google committed to removing restrictions imposed on advertisers trying to coordinate their online advertising campaigns across several platforms. I'm reading from the Wall Street Journal. And the journal mentions that its parent company, News Corp, has filed formal complaints with the commission about Google's business practices. So there you go. Thank you for the disclaimer at the end of the story. Anything else we want to say before we wrap this thing up?
Can we talk about the AI that defeated the army? Not the army.
the jet pilot.
the alpha AI. I thought that was like both kind of scary and cool.
Yeah.
And what was it? And what was it powered by?
It was a pilot AI developed by a doctoral grad student from the University of Cincinnati.
In a virtual dogfight.
This is not these were not real planes. It's not autonomous Air Force yet, but it was, I think, two U.S. Air Force.
Retired U.S. Air Force colonel and a.
An actual pilot?
A current pilot? I don't know. I mean, the colonel was a pilot. He is retired.
He's more like a battle technician or tactician.
They defeated several experts. This is from let's go to the original. The paper is from the Journal of Defense Management, which means I probably can't read it without.
I thought they were using a Raspberry Pi, though. I thought they were.
No. No.
Yeah.
Genetic fuzzy-based artificial intelligence for unmanned combat aerial vehicle control in simulated air combat missions. Breakthroughs in genetic fuzzy systems.
So fuzzy logic.
Yeah.
So it breaks the tasks up, and it does it do statistical weighting in fuzzy logic? That's the question I'm trying to figure out.
Fuzzy is robust, adaptable, high-performing, computationally efficient, and provides an excellent framework to synthesize formal models for the purposes of verification and validation. However, to date, it suffers heavily from the, quote, curse of dimensionality, end quote. That is, as the scope of the problem increases, the computational cost increases rapidly. That's why, by the way, they chunked it up. So this is not yet something you're going to put in an airplane and send into the sky to beat the bad guys. It says a standard fuzzy-based system would be extremely computationally intractable for a problem like air-to-air combat. I guess they've made a breakthrough that makes it a little bit more computationally inexpensive using a genetic fuzzy tree.
Got it.
Which sounds like a Dr. Seuss plant.
It sounds like that plant with the
yeah.
Yucca. What kind of the Spanish dagger?
Spanish dagger. My yucca is a genetic fuzzy tree.
Oh, and now I found a PDF, a comparison of fuzzy, Bayesian, and weighted average.
Oh, please. I told you, didn't I? Or maybe you weren't here when I told you. I bought a book because I want to learn about this using Python for machine learning. And I literally, even though I was reading it in the early evening, went comatose after the first chapter. I was like...
So I'm going to recommend Jeff Hinton has...
Oh, I like
Coursera?
Jeff
Hinton. Yeah, so yeah. He's got a Coursera on convolutional neural nets that's great.
Oh, well, there you go.
And if you can find anything with Jan LeCun, who works at Facebook, having Jan explain how a machine learning network and unsupervised machine learning works,
wow,
your brain is just like, oh, it's so awesome that I'm a journalist and
I'm
have this time.
I'm impressed.
It's good. So I encourage that. Or just take the Coursera course with Jeff.
Did you take the course?
I took the first part of it.
I'm impressed.
And there's an AMA. Actually, his Reddit AMA is actually really good.
Okay.
So I would, Jeff Hinton's GEOFF, I think. Let's see.
GEOFF. He's a distinguished researcher at Google.
Yes, he's the Google
guy.
At
the University of Toronto.
So I put a link in the rundown because I saw this on Reddit earlier and I didn't know it was in there. But I saw it because they claim it was powered by Raspberry Pi. I wasn't kidding.
Oh.
There's a Newsweek article that actually claims that they were using Raspberry Pi for this test.
That's even more scary.
Are they the $5 Pi Zeros or are they the
No, I'm sure these are the $35 versions because they have quad-core CPUs and...
So we need $500 to build an AI that can take out.
Well, hey, I'm all for it. Just put in a little plane and, send it up in a drone or something and protect our shores.
We'll have Ender's Game happening right here in a few years.
Yeah. Wow.
Oh, no, Ender was an actual person. Never mind.
Yeah, but he was, maybe we could control him with a Raspberry Pi.
We could create it. We'll call him Ender. That's what they should
call it. Ender.
Not Alpha. It should have been Ender.
We'll call it Ender.
Ender Wiggins. Okay.
Wow, that's a wild story. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I was looking at the research PDF. They didn't mention the fact that they were using a Raspberry Pi. And that was in real time that they were doing that? Wow.
That's what it said. It has to be, right? It has to be in real time.
Right. If it's a dog fight.
Yeah, it's real time.
Oh, I think it's just a matter of time now.
Wow.
Robots cool take stuff. Over.
Super
is,
cool
is
stuff.
Is your project a Raspberry Pi fighter pilot this week, Aaron?
No, not.
Okay. Can you work on that for next week?
Yeah, I'll have it ready for next Wednesday.
Raspberry Pi powered AI.
Oh, if you could download that code onto some Pis, run it on a drone, you could have some really cool aerial battles happening. Look at that.
Doesn't seem possible. By the way, the colonel said it was the first time he'd seen an AI consistently beat a human pilot in tests. U.S. Air Force Colonel Gene Lee. And it beat Lee every single time. By the way, this beats your Vive. Holy cow. I want one of these. Oh, that was too short. Only 6 seconds of excitement. Wow. All right, let's wrap this thing up. It's time if anybody has a tip. Why don't we start with you, Aaron, because you brought us a little project here.
Yeah, and I actually sent a video, which is in the rundown, because I know I'm in the studio, but it was too late.
No, that's fine.
Kind of last minute for me today, so I couldn't join.
Well, we weren't sure if Jeff would be able to get through, but he's managed to do it anyway. Oh, it says they're still processing the video. They're still processing
the video. Yeah, there's another link below that I shared.
I'll do the photos,
Google photos, see if you can bring that up. Yeah. But anyway, this is what it is. It's a project I actually made for my son as part of one of his things that he was doing for class. And this is really simple. It's very similar to the 20-sided die that I brought in one time that told you what position it landed on. But all it is a keypad. Keypads are real cheap. You can get them for a couple of bucks on eBay. mounted to a little project box with the speaker inside. And when you hit the code, it actually will do a message. So let's see if I can
make it. There's a message for you.
There it goes.
There's a message for you.
So, got the box here. You just put in the code. And if you put in the correct code, it plays whatever message you want. And, of course, you could have multiple codes and multiple messages. But on the inside, it's all powered by an Arduino. This one happens to be a Pro Mini. It's very similar to the Nano. So it's, you know, again, very cheap, $3 or $4 on eBay. You can get these things. And a sound module that when you get the correct code in, it triggers the sound to play. And that's it. And you could easily modify this. That little sound module there, again, is probably about $5 on eBay, and it stores, I think, about 2 megabytes worth of sound files. And you can trigger those either through a serial command back to that module, or you can trigger it just by shorting a pin to ground, and it'll play the first or second or third sound that's loaded on the board. And then the case was, you know, just a project case that we had. I milled out some little mounts for it and a hole for the LED and all that. Really simple project to do. And it works quite nicely.
Nice handwork there, Carol Merrill.
Yes, that's right. Well, I had to be Vanna. You know, that's my own project. You could also use this instead of, you know, sending that signal to play a sound on that little board I showed. You could also use this to...
Could we trigger a thermonuclear war? Oh, okay.
Well, that's actually the advanced version of this will be in the White House in case... Trump ever gets elected, just to trick him. From
Mr. Trump, I haven't given you the code yet. Hang around a little bit here.
Try a different code. No, but you could use this. You could modify this really easily and put a servo instead of the MP3 player board I showed, and you could have like a little electronic latch, so you could make your own combination lock for a box or for something, or make something for the kids where they have to know the secret code in order to get into their toy box or something like that.
I like it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of really cool – it's like a starter project, but there's lots of really cool applications. You can take it to next levels if you want to. So,
have you posted the plans anywhere, or did you find them anywhere?
Not yet. I just made it up, but I'll post. If you're interested in doing this yourself, reach out on Twitter, and I'll send you a link to some instructions on how you can do it.
Aaron Newcomb. What's your Twitter handle?
Aaron Newcomb.
Oh, that's
all
easy.
At Aaron Newcomb. Yep.
You know, Jeff Jarvis, who's in Mexico City, I meant to ask you, give you a chance if you want. Hillary Clinton's campaign has released her kind of policy paper for technology, and I was very impressed. And I know you're
I haven't read it yet. Yeah, I'm a Clinton supporter. I have not read it yet. I'm eager to.
Yeah. I mean, the problem, of course, I have is that it's easy to say anything, it's what you do in office, but as since nobody's in office yet, we have to decide from what they say they're going to do. And this is pretty impressive, including I think an understanding. Obviously, she's got staffers who have a deep understanding of what some of the issues are. She wants to invest in computer science and STEM education, provide every student in America an opportunity to learn computer science, train up to 50,000 computer science teachers in the next decade. Build a human talent pipeline for 21st century jobs is kind of what you were talking about, Stacey. Open the higher education job training landscape, reboot job training around industry needs and job credentials. A lot of this is aimed at, by the way, Silicon Valley and concerns Silicon Valley has about a workforce that is not sufficient to provide the brains they need. Diversify the tech workforce, increase access to capital for growth-oriented small businesses and startups, so the focus is on minority women and young entrepreneurs, defer student loans to help young entrepreneurs, attract and retain top talent from around the world. And I think she also talks about closing the digital divide in terms of bandwidth and providing something I've said for a long time. Internet access, as we had in the past, provided electricity especially to rural areas through a government internetification projects. Reduce.
And now that,
go ahead.
I was going to say, now that we have better technologies, like the FCC's 5G plan, keep an eye on that because that's going to help us get gigabit wireless, which will be way less costly to dig than fiber.
She talks about that, deploying 5G wireless and next generation wireless services. Connect more anchor institutions, high-speed internet. I mean, all of this, these are all the right words. Absolutely. Fight for an open internet abroad. Go ahead, Jeff.
The other side is just going to say, I have the most technology.
I got a great plan.
I have the best technology. I have more technology than anybody else.
I'm smarter.
That's real time.
Defend net neutrality. Improve the patent system to reward innovators. Reduce excessive patent litigation. Effective copyright policy. And, of course, there's going to be some IP stuff in here that some of us may not be thrilled about, but. You know,
yeah, and some security stuff, you know, anti-Snowden stuff.
Protect online privacy as well as security. Clinton rejects the false choice between privacy interests and keeping Americans safe. That's going to be an interesting nut to crack.
I reject that, too. But,
yeah,
you know,
but how do you, devil's in the details, exactly. Make government simpler, more friendly, transform government services. There's a lot of good stuff in here. And it's worth reading. It's long, and there's a lot of information. But there, it needs to be long because I think there's a lot of detail in here. And I think the key on this is if she is elected president, and I think she will be, keeping this document in front of us and holding her feet to the fire and saying, okay, here's what you promised. Let's see that you do it. Jeff, you have a number for us?
Well, first, on my Twitter feed, I give you the scene where I am.
I see this. I thought you were in your hotel room. What, did you decide to go out late at night?
I kept on the Phi. No, I'm out of the courtyard here with my pool, and I'm on the Phi with this better Wi-Fi. That's
but now cute. This looks like a murder scene, but in fact, she is a model, and they are taking her picture, not shooting her.
Yes. And I just tweeted another one where there's Jim Jarmusch standing behind her.
What? Jim Jarmusch is there? I like your poolside. This is where you are right now?
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah, I had a little cerveza.
Dude.
Why are you talking to us?
Yeah, really. Dude.
I know. That's how dedicated I am. That's how foolish I am. So, number. So in,
I won't blame you if you're a little distracted, Jeff.
Yeah, I know. It's well, but you can't stare. You know,
no,
be wrong.
You can't. That would be wrong.
So, in her keynote at VidCon, YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki put up a slide that said, and I quote, 40% of millennials say YouTube creators understand them better than their friends.
Wow. Ooh. Wow.
Amazing. And I saw it.
That's depressing.
I saw people who. Yeah.
I guess teenagers have always thought that.
Yeah. And some of them are quite cute and wholesome.
Right.
Yeah.
Mickey Dolenz understood me better than my friends.
Well, it's also, if you're a geek, and aren't we all, that's a place, YouTube is a place where you can find people like you and people who do, you know, would be empathetic to you and understand
right.
you and you, and you feel a connection.
You know what? That is really true. If you're a geek, you probably don't have a lot of geek friends, but you can go online and find those geek friends.
Okay, wait. YouTube is not just for geeks. I go on there for makeup tutorials and hair stuff all the time.
By the way,
my daughter.
It's working beautifully.
Oh, yes, no. but if you want to learn how to
makeup
do a smoky
geek.
Eye.
Wait a minute. You're 9-year-old. You're making her, you're having her look at makeup and.
So the makeup is for me because, like, I was a geek and I had no idea how to really do makeup. Still don't, but, you know, I'm getting there. But for she's got really long hair. And so we do like these. I did a Elsa hairdo with her because she really wanted one after Frozen came out.
Like,
it's amazing. And then you see all these. Anyway,
you can learn French braids. You can learn how to do
Dutch braids.
Yeah,
all kinds of crazy.
Yeah. No, YouTube's great for that. I agree 100%.
I just, you know, I wouldn't want people to think it's only for geeks.
But do you, well, let me ask you, Stacey. Do you think your YouTube friends understand you better than your real life friends?
So I don't have YouTube friends. Have you not read the comments on YouTube videos?
Yes, you do. Leo Laporte.
I'm your YouTube friend. I'm your internet friend,
Stacey.
We've never met, but I'll be your internet friend.
We have never met, Leo.
Isn't that weird?
Or my internet friend.
Yeah. We'll meet someday. Someday. We'll all go to Mexico City. Why is Jim Jarmusch at the pool there?
Who is Jim Jarmusch?
He's speaking at the same conference.
Great director.
Filmmaker.
Okay. Yeah. Filmmaker, not, more filmmaker than director. Stacey, your tip, your tool, your trick.
Okay, I've got two. One, because I'm goofy. Ta-da!
Happy 4th of July! Woo!
This is my point. And when you walk, they spin.
Oh.
They're $3 at Target. I recommend them for everyone.
Are you going to wear them on Monday?
Oh, heck yeah. We have a big 4th of July party. And
Like at your house?
At our house, we have. Fun. You're about to see, because I'm going to show you for the thing I'm showing
you. Are you allowed to do safe and sane fireworks in your neck of the woods?
So we have this rooftop deck that overlooks the Austin Country Club's fireworks.
Perfect.
So, yes. And basically, it's really beautiful because, like, all the people are out on the lake under next to the country club. So you get the boats on the water and their lights, and then you get the fireworks above you. It's super awesome.
And lest you think that what kind of fireworks could the Austin Country Club offer? Here from 2014, the fireworks over Lake Austin. You're going to have fun.
They're like literally at eye level, like not even a mile away.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
They're
great. We have a big party. I would love to do this as my tip and show you. So what I'm doing is I set up the Netgear Arlo cameras, because I'm doing a thing where I'm testing outdoor cameras. This one isn't set up, obviously, because it's still got the thing on. Now, I will say that these just had a security issue that was a big deal on Reddit.
That's not the one. Those aren't the cameras where the guy sent it back and then the next guy had it and he was able to watch the next guy through the camera. Have they fixed that yet?
So here's the scapegoating that's happening there. Is they're like, well, when someone returns them, the retailer is not supposed to sell them.
Oh, put it back on the shelf. That makes sense.
And that's what happened.
They're supposed to send it back to Netgear for reset. Yeah.
Right. So I'm like, I want fewer chains. I want fewer like possible weak links in my chain, or fewer links in my chain be weak.
Yeah.
So, but I still like the camera. Mine are brand new from Netgear. So maybe you should buy them online.
Yeah.
My camera pack came with four of these and a base station. I don't really love that they have a base station that I have to use a port for, but I do like these cameras. This is maybe 1.2 pounds. Probably. I'm trying to see.
Have you used the drop cams, or as they call them, nest cams now?
I have used the drop cams.
How do they compare?
The drop kit. Here's what's key. This is wireless and this is indoor and outdoor.
Yeah.
So these are, to me, a totally different use
case. Yeah, drop cams can't be used outdoors.
They can't be used outdoors, and they're wired.
Yeah.
So it comes with this magnetic mount. I actually just stuck, I have silver railings, and I just stuck these on the railings, and they've so far been up through a rainstorm and some decent winds.
Wow.
Outside. The magnetic mount comes with like a little keyhole thing in the back. So you could just stick a nail in one of the trees and just dunk it on there for the other side of the house. And here's what the camera looks like, just so you guys can see. I don't love the app. I'm going to be honest here. Let's see. Is it too bright for y'all still? Yeah, it's too bright. Hold on.
Yeah.
Okay. Oop. Let's get my text out of the way. Oh, let me set up the camera so you can see. It takes a minute for it to like load. It's got motion sensing, all that other good stuff. So it's still loading.
Do they need power? Or when you say wireless, do they not need, battery powered?
So the bottom camera's working. This one's still trying to load. So
they're battery powered?
They're battery powered.
Nice. And presumably they'll last, what, a month, 2 months? I mean, they're not on all the time, right? That's why it's starting up, because it has to come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Press live.
That camera failed to work.
Well, press it again. Maybe it'll.
I am.
But that's how these battery cameras work. They can't stay on all the time, otherwise they die very quickly.
They don't. But they do have a motion sensor. So there
you go. Is. Nice. Wow, you're gonna have a good view of the fireworks.
That's why we have the party. So I was actually looking for. I shared it with Kevin. I was looking for a place to like show it publicly, like to share that camera publicly during the fireworks, because I thought that was super fun.
You should.
But I can't.
If you want, stream it to us and we'll show it.
There you go.
We got more bandwidth than God now.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I'll thank Dave for that.
Yeah.
So I like these so far. I'm actually going to be testing a bunch of these out over the next couple of months, because I'm in the market for this and I get a lot of questions about outdoor kind of capable security cameras.
This is a huge category. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And I put them on the roof because during our party, we often get kids trying to climb those railings, and it's a tall drop if they go over. So I'd like to be able to see.
I ordered a, and it still hasn't come yet, and I ordered it a long time ago, a weather station that has a built-in cam.
Huh.
And then it it makes it public, and it makes a time-lapse of your locale public. So that's I can go see my neighborhood. I can go see downtown New York. The name of that is. While I'm trying to find the name of that, have you used the Eero Wi-Fi devices yet?
I'm on them now. I actually bought them for my house. I liked them.
They're
so much.
So expensive.
So yeah, the Luma's out, and then there's a new system called Plum that's coming out.
I'm waiting for my Lumas. I pre-ordered the Lumas.
Check out Plum. That's a really interesting model. They're actually just the radios, and instead of a processor on the box, it's actually all in the cloud.
So the Eero is like $500 for three units, mm-hmm. $400 for the Luma, and the Plum is how much?
Ooh,
less, I would guess.
It's a different thing, and so.
But the theory of all of these is they make it easier to do Wi-Fi extenders, right?
So they're not Wi-Fi extenders. They're actually a Wi-Fi mesh.
It's a mesh.
Oh, Plum. It's not Plum. I'm
Plume.
Sorry.
Oh yeah.
Forgive me. Plum is a light switch. That's a Wi-Fi light switch.
The IoT is getting to you now. There's too much IoT.
That is true.
So I've actually had two Eero. This is my third Eero. The first one I got was paired to somebody else, and you have to get the person who originally used it to deactivate it. Kind of like that camera.
Yes.
But that was a review unit, and they obviously sent it to some other journalist first. So the second unit I got, I never got it to work. I had to put all three units in the same room, which doesn't really create much of a mesh. But but they said, please try one more time. We must have given you a bad unit. So I tried one more time, and you know what? Wow. It really does work.
Yeah. Now,
I don't know if it's worth $500, but we have a very challenging house. And Lisa, who drives me crazy all the time, saying the internet doesn't work. God damn it! I thought you were the tech guy. She's nicer about it, but that's what I hear. She goes, "Honey, the internet's down," and I hear, "I thought you were the tech guy."
I have that voice too.
She's happy. She's the first time I've ever seen her say, "Wow, it's been working everywhere, super fast." So I'm now going to revise my opinion of the Eero. I was wondering if you tried it. So you're on it.
I'm on it.
And incidentally, normally on Wi-Fi, you're not on Wi-Fi, though.
I am on Wi-Fi, Leo.
Okay, well, Karsten will vouch for it. We don't let people use Wi-Fi because it's so terrible.
I wasn't going to tell you.
Well, but you can because this works great and you haven't had a single dropout.
It does. Now, I will say, here's the caveats. My Eeros are on a LAN, so each Eero is plugged into the LAN. If you have your Eeros doing... Okay, there's words for this, and I'm going to mess them up.
Mine are not on a LAN. I have a base unit, and then I have extenders.
For every hop, you're going to lose a little bit of capacity.
Yeah, but that's the way it is in life.
But it's not like an extender.
For every hop you take in life, you lose a little capacity.
That is true.
Yes.
Wait, is that shots or hops? But anyway, these are working really well.
So each one of them is plugged into the a wired internet.
Yeah, because I built my house in 2013, so I've got Ethernet ports.
Nice. But they're still meshing?
They are still meshing. And all of the new mesh routers are going to work pretty much the same is kind of my understanding. The Plume is a little bit different.
Yeah.
But we can go into that if you want to try those.
Yeah, we'll get reviews as you try the various things. I have the Luma on order as well, but I'm very pleased that the Eero worked so well. This, by the way, is the Bloom Sky. I'm going to put this on my roof. It's the camera with a weather station. So you can see people's time lapses. And they have an app so you can see people's time lapses if you share them.
Can you get the temperature data?
Yeah. It's a little weather station that also streams.
Nice.
And you don't need to have the weather station to use the app, but I ordered the weather station so that I could be... I want to put this on the new studio, on the roof of the new studio, so you can see what the weather is.
And that also runs on battery?
That's a good question. I guess it does. How does it do it? How do it work? I don't see it. Oh, no. There's a little power line.
Power over Ethernet, maybe?
Oh, no. Solar. See that? No. That's a solar panel.
Oh.
There you go.
Solar would be.
Solar, baby.
Wow. That's super efficient
solar baby. Man. Isn't that
cool?
Did
you see your Ring doorbell added a solar panel?
Yes. We even have a deal for our listeners, but I'll save that for another show because we're running out of time. I got one more thing to show you. This comes from Kitsy, real name Christian Ristovsky. If the biggest problem with speech interfaces is remembering what the syntax is and what things it can do, I have to say Alexa has improved considerably, the Alexa store. This is for Google. Okay, Google folks, this is a website, ok-google.io, that lists all of them, all the Google commands. So you can play with them. You can get to know them in one place, which you'd think Google would have done.
What does it say the tip is? I wonder what its tipping rate was. Did you see that one?
Which?
It said, what's the tip? It was under
math, probably, right?
Math or conversion.
Conversion.
It was like, what's the tip?
What's the tip for 60? I don't know. What do you think the rate is? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Is it like tipping at 20% or 15?
Well, you just try it and let me know.
I was going to say.
I think what it does is gives you a choice.
Oh.
But this is cool, isn't it? And by the way, he's really into, this is like a React.js site, so he's really into all the kind of stuff. So as you hover the mouse around, things happen, and it's kind of fun. I don't know. I kind of like it. Google.
I like that because I always forget.
Yeah.
I forgot about askew, for example. If you do OK Google and then say askew, it gives you the definition for askew, but as it does it, it turns your web page slightly sideways.
S-K-E-W.
Which is hilarious.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So these are obviously for the phone one. This doesn't have those Easter eggs in it, but it's handy. OK-google.io. And Kitsy, would you now write one for Alexa, for Echo, please? Because I can't remember what I can ask my Echo.
Oh, and well, we'll talk about it next week.
Yeah, you want it next week? Will you come back and join us next week?
Me?
Yes.
Aaron?
Please.
I will be here.
Please. Jeff Jarvis, will you be back in town next week?
I rescheduled a trip around, so by God, I'm going to be home.
Oh, you don't have to reschedule. I know summertime's your travel time. It's okay.
But I'm traveled up, man.
All right. Yeah, I bet you are. Well, enjoy your cerveza and the view, and say hi to Jim Jarmusch for me.
Will do.
All right. Jeff Jarvis is at the City University of New York, where he teaches during the class year. He teaches journalism, but he's also a blogger at buzzmachine.com. Stacey Higginbotham is at stacyoniot.com and iotpodcast.com. Is Kevin allowed, even though he was working for Google now, to continue to podcast?
Yes.
Can you ask him if he would ever come on our show?
I will. No, I jealously guard Kevin.
You don't have to. But we love Kevin. I like to talk about the Beatles with Kevin.
Oh, he got a tattoo.
A Beatles tattoo?
Oh, yeah.
Of what?
I think it's the album name. I didn't actually ask to see it.
Silly man. Well, it's not like anybody's going to replace the Beatles anytime soon.
No, it's pretty good. It's going to stay the same forever. Same logo and everything.
Aaron Newcomb, of course, a regular on Floss Weekly. We'd like to have him on All About Android. He's been on the new Screensavers. We love having him on Twig, too. Thank you for stepping in on short notice. He's at Plus Aaron Newcomb on. Oh, I forgot to mention, Google Plus is now 5 years old this week.
Ooh,
and like most five-year-olds.
I love Google Plus still.
Yeah, Mike. Most five-year-olds, it's dying. it's like fading away. Five years in social media term is an infinity. Thank you all for being here. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern Time, 20:30 UTC. If you want to join us live, join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. We'd love having you. If you can't, don't worry. On-demand audio and video is always available for all of our shows, in this case, twit.tv/twig, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, then you won't miss an episode of This Week in Google. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Twig. Bye-bye.